Welcome you all to this work session. First, we will have an approval of the agenda. Y'all had a chance to review that?
So moved.
Have a second? Second. Motion to approve the agenda been seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Unanimous. We will first have the discussion regarding statewide buck-doe ratios. I don't know who's going to give that, Jim. Ace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically what I was asked to do is just kind of give a background on how we got here and then kind of, you know, where we may go in the future and what changing buck-doe ratios, you know, would entail and, how much could we increase permits or and so on and so forth. I gave you guys a few sheets of paper there. The top one says Utah Statewide Mule Deer Management Plan, past, present, and future. And that basically just goes through how we got to this point. So we basically passed the deer management plan, or you guys did, in 2008. And then this plan was drafted. Obviously, most of our plans are. We got a committee together of interested parties and took their input and drafted this plan before it was approved. And a couple of the things that we, unit by unit and buck-doe ratios certainly came up at this committee. The committee did not decide to go unit by unit for a multitude of reasons, one of them being, limiting hunters to a specific unit. They felt that made hunters have to choose a unit. So if it wasn't needed, they didn't want that to be the recommendation. And we also discussed buck-doe ratio quite a bit, raising it to produce possibly bigger antlered animals. And again, that one was not one that they wanted to raise, basically because it would reduce opportunity. They did, however, raise the upper end of that objective. It used to be 15 to 20, if you remember. And then in the new plan, it's 15 to 25. What this does is basically it keeps us from ever raising permits until we get to almost a limited entry type situation. So that is one thing they did to basically keep permits from going up, but they didn't want to reduce them by a large amount either by raising the lower end of the objective to 18. And again, we discussed that at length with this committee. And then as we know, in 09, the board passed a motion that we actually take unit by unit out as an option, and we did so in November 2010, along with two options that raised the objective slightly, but still maintained regional hunting, and that the division favored the regional hunting option during that presentation. And then, as you know, the Wildlife Board considered all the public comment that went through that. It was fairly divided, as you know, and what we've got now is a unit by unit associated with an 18 to 25 buck-to-doe ratio objective. So we've got 30 units statewide with an objective currently of 18 to 25 bucks per 100 does that would be managing for 2012. And that's kind of how, the Reader's Digest version of how we got here. So this most recent RAC, we've basically been going through and just recommending season dates for the 2012 season. And then in the future, the statewide plan is currently due up for revision December 2013. But we do hope to maybe push that back a little bit to the May 2014. Basically, this would give us 2 years of harvest data on unit by unit. And if we're going to, it would, mean not that long of a delay between December and May, but it would give us more information to go on. And then we do hope to address the buck-to-doe rate. We did hope to raise the buck-to-doe ratio objective at that time because we did feel that the range is fairly large and, maybe we could shrink that range. And when we do get above a certain buck-to-doe ratio, we could increase permits and then maybe address some of the things that we might discuss today. That's basically all the background. We were at 15 bucks per 100 does on the past plan. We are at 18 in the current plan. That does reduce permits by quite a bit. I've given you a second sheet that has kind of a table on it with the numbers, and that goes through and basically given a certain buck-to-doe ratio, how many permits it would take to, once you achieve that buck-to-doe ratio, to maintain that buck-to-doe ratio. So basically, if all 30 units were at 15 bucks per 100 does, you could issue, you know, almost 98,000 permits if all units were at that objective. And then similarly, 18, which is where we are now, if all 30 units were at objective and you were managing for about 18 bucks per 100 does, you could issue roughly 80,000 permits. So, you know, that gives you kind of an idea of how many permits you could have, one versus the other. And obviously, if we do want to tackle this and go with some sort of a hybrid approach where some units are 15, some units are 18, it would fall somewhere between those two numbers. And if, you know, I guess I'll just open it up for any kind of discussion that you guys might have.
15 to 18. To less than 80,000.
Yeah.
Slope moving.
Obviously.
Level out at 80.
Yeah, obviously this is the point where if you were at objective, this is what you could issue. Yeah, if you're trying to increase, you would have to actually have lower number of permits until you get there, and then once you get there, you can level off at that 80,000. So, you know, obviously there's so many different units that are different objectives, it's hard to just say what we would need to get there. We could say on a specific unit-by-unit basis how many permits it would take, but this is more of a statewide approach, kind of see where...
Have you got an idea if there was to be some kind of a proposal put together for this hybrid system you mentioned? How many units do you think would fit into a 15 as opposed to the 18?
Yeah.
And what would those units be?
Yeah, that's not anything I've really tackled yet, just to, you know, be honest with you. I wouldn't even want to gander.
I guess because, it can be whatever we.
Yeah, because it's a tough one because, you know, it's such a socially driven thing. Which units are going to be what? I mean, we could set some sidelines to them, like maybe, you know, we would want units that are well roaded to be in the 15 because they're harder to reach the 18 because harvest is high and all those things. But to really just come up with a number here would be hard. It would take some thought and obviously some public input as well. So.
Anise, you talked about December 2013 for the new plan and rolling it forward another 6 months till you get current data for that year.
Right.
Seemed like to me that, and I like that idea, but it just seemed like that's going to affect the draw. How would that handle the draw if we're going to?
Yeah. If we finish the plan in, you know, March of 2013, we usually set, it would be May. So, yeah, it would come at the same time. So if that was the case, and we've done this before, we would kind of have dual proposals, one based on the old plan, one based on the new plan. If the new plan is passed, we would, you know, set the permits at that point based on the new plan.
Thank you. Any other questions from the board?
I got a question for you, Niece. Have you taken a look at some of the bigger public land units and actually compared how many permits you'd have to cut on each unit for 15 to 18? I mean, do we have can we put a number to the number of permits we would be saving on any given unit? I mean, can you give us an idea of what we're dealing with there?
Yeah, we've done it. It all depends on how many a deer are on that unit, so you can do it by 10. If we've done it, we've done kind of analysis on 10,000 deer and how many permits you would have to cut. And yeah, we've done it for most units in the state. Again, it varies by unit, so it's hard for me to just say, but I mean, it's going to be quite a, you know, so it's, if you take the statewide approach, it's 98,000 to 80, so that's, you know, almost 20,000 right there. So if you take two big units in the state, you could probably add a couple, 2,000 or 3,000 back in just by doing that. Hard to say unless you have a specific unit in mind, we can run the numbers.
Would unit, I hear a lot about a lot of units. I talked to a guy while I was elk hunting down on the Manti this year, and his concern for maintaining the current number of deer hunters on the Manti, he says, I says, well, you know, hunters, you know, the buck doe ratio don't really affect the deer population.
Right.
And he says, I understand that. He says, my concern is this. He said, if we have the same number of deer hunters hunting a certain number of bucks in a deer population that's not out objective, he says, even though our ratio may be the same, he says, the actual number of bucks that the same number of hunters are hunting has gone down. So you keep the same pressure on a smaller number of bucks, and it's kind of, he says, isn't it kind of shrinking the actual number of bucks we're hunting? He says, and I understand it's not going to affect the deer herd. He says, but it just doesn't seem right to keep the same number of hunters hunting a smaller number of bucks.
Yeah, but if the number of bucks is decreasing, that would also reduce the buck to doe ratio. The buck to doe ratio can't stay high if you have fewer bucks. So for a given population, if your number of bucks is decreasing, your buck to doe ratio will decrease as well, unless your does are dying at the same rate, which they're not. There's no way they're dying at the same rate we're harvesting bucks. They're just not, you know. But we know that they're not, because they're, yeah, from our radio collar data, they're living, you know, from year to year at 85% survival rate. So we know they're not. So if that can't happen, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
If you have the same number of hunters with fewer numbers of bucks, then your buck to doe ratio is going to drop.
Your buck to doe ratio will reflect it.
Drop, yeah.
Okay.
And that's why buck to doe ratio is such a good indicator of buck harvest, because it correlates well with the population, because you're doing it, you're comparing it to the does. Now, you know, that's, and I've said that many times, but I think it's hard for people to grasp.
Well, it's, you know, when they look at the numbers and see a deer herd that used to be right, huge, and now it's 50% or slightly less, it's hard for them to swallow the fact that we're going to keep the same number of hunters there. That just doesn't jive.
Yeah, and we wouldn't if buck to doe ratios drop, which means the population either decreased or the number of bucks decreased, then we would cut hunters as well to maintain a buck to doe ratio.
Okay.
Buck to doe ratios track populations really well, because they are part of the population.
I guess that's one of the things I do really like about the specific units, is you can look at each unit and kind of, you know, tailor the permits. So, okay, thank you.
Anish, the handout here says that you were going to look at buck to does during the plan revision process in a couple of years, along with the unit by unit and what that's produced. But this is year one of whatever we do.
Mm-hmm.
So if the board reconsidered and modified to something this year, effective 2011 hunt, that's neutral to what you're trying to do. You just want to maintain it for 2 years, right?
Right. Basically we would manage for 18 bucks for the next 2 years, and then look at the data and see kind of where we are, and maybe set some new objectives in the new plan, either shrinking the objective down or having multiple objectives on multiple units.
Don't think you understood me. Let me try it again. If the board changed today and said we want to go to 17, not 18,
sure,
or we want to go to 20, not 18,
right,
that's completely neutral to what you're saying in this paper. You just want to do whatever we're going to do in 2011 and hold it steady.
2012.
2012.
Well, we would still
for two.
And whenever the plan is up for revision, we would still revisit that and gain, you know, comment or whatever. I guess it wouldn't just roll over into the new plan, unless that's what you guys want to do. You know, our plans are usually 5-year plans, so we would revisit it in 2 years regardless of what happens here, just because that's how our plans are set up. Unless you ask me to from here on start the new 5-year plan.
Ernie, are you asking then, so do we want the same thing for the next 2 years, or are we going to, is that what you're asking?
Well, what I'm basically saying is, do you have an objection? Are you saying that you object to changing anything today?
No, I don't object to changing anything at any time. provided it's based on, you know, good information.
Mean it that way either, yeah. Denise. I know you don't. You're very good at that.
Yeah.
But there's no division objection from any basis on a reconsideration of that 18 across the board.
There is one thing I would like. If we are going to do it, I would rather do it now than in a year, because then we have 2 years of different data to compare. And that's, you know.
And you'd rather have 2 years of different data than?
No, I'd rather have 2 years of similar data, because it kind of starts to show you a trend, than doing 1 year for 18 and then the second year splitting it. Then when we go to redo the plan, we have 2 years that you can't really compare.
So whatever we do, if we could hold it for 2 years, it now, hold it for 2 years, so that when the new plan comes, you have some data that you can actually draw from.
That would be best, yes.
I got another question.
Sure.
Have we looked at weapon type splits and how that could affect the number of permits that we cut? I mean, I'm obviously a stick
obviously
flicker,
we have.
But
yeah. And you know, there is a trade off. Obviously, if you go heavier on archery, you're going to be able to put more permits out there. But the majority of hunters are rifle hunters, so. The split we have here on this is 60-20-20. That's kind of a middle ground, both for social and biological reasons. We could go heavier on the archery, and we'd be able to have more permits, but then you're going to have outcry from the rifle hunters because they don't get to hunt. So the optimum would be obviously 50% archery and 50% split amongst muzzleloader and whatever, but obviously you can't do that because then a majority of the hunters would be sitting at home on the couch. And, you know, unless they decide to become archers, which
if,
I don't.
If we look at the permits that, say, we look at the total permits that if we go through the plan as it is right now that we'd be cutting between this year and next, and we take those and instead of just cut them, roll some of those. I don't know if we can really say we're saving many deer if we put them in muzzleloader anymore.
No, muzzleloader and rifle are fairly the same.
But can you take a pretty good chunk of those and put them into archery? And I mean, you'd save some revenue. There would still be some harvest, but it would be about half of what it was.
Yeah, you certainly
could
do that.
Could you work something like
that? You could do that, but any permits you take are going from somewhere. So
I understand.
If you take
that.
Them from rifle and make them an archery permit, then basically you could take half of those and put them into archery and have the same harvest. So what you're looking for is just moving harvest around, whether they're being harvested by archers or not. So, yeah, you could double the number of archers for the same, you know, permits that you have for. But, again, you're given one weapon type more opportunity than the others. So that's where the balance has to be struck. I'm not the one to say where it needs to be struck, but looking at our socially driven data, about 60-20-20 is where it seems to fall in from how many people put in for the different weapon types.
I'm just thinking, I mean, if it come down to not hunting or hunting with my bow, I mean, I think there's quite a number of guys that would that hunt everything. I mean, dedicated hunter, you know.
Sure.
So I guess, you know, that's just something we got to look at. Is it better to stay home or hunt with a weapon that's not your first choice?
Right. And we've asked that question in surveys before, you know, what would be your most favorable way to have more permits but less harvest? And that comes up all the time, that they are willing. But then when we look at how many people put in for different things, it always ends up skewed towards the rifle hunter. So maybe when we redo the plan in 2013 or 14, we could specifically ask people, if you were not able to hunt with a rifle, would you pick up a bow? And that'll give us a better idea of kind of.
Would you have to take that drastic of a split? I mean, if you took, you know, 10% of those tags, I mean, that's.
Sure. Yeah, I agree. I mean, if you put the more you put into archery, the more permits you could have per deer killed.
I think you could take some of those tags, put them into archery. You'd make a lot of guys pretty happy, and No. I don't think you'd have major outcry if you didn't put them all into, or right. half of them,
right.
you know.
Yeah, I don't and think I, it'd have again, to be a substantial number. I'm not advocating half, but I'm just saying, you know, it's just, it's a split that seems, at least a 60-20-20, that seems to fit what how people are hunting right now, if given the choice.
My next question for you on that 60-20-20, does that have to be the same on all these units? Would it be a, we talked about having options, you know, $15 per 100 does or 18. Why does the 60-20-20 have to be the same?
Nothing has to be anything. It's just that we like consistency. It makes it easier for us. It makes it easier for the hunters. It makes it easier for everybody. And we do want, it, you know, the more complicated you make things, obviously, the more error that creeps into things and all other things that happen. Obviously, it doesn't have to be that way on every unit. But, you know, consistency is also a good thing because then there's less error when we're doing recommendations. We don't have to make sure, oh, yeah, this unit is different than that unit. We can just abroad. And then.
But it could be workable. I mean, as long as we didn't get 20 options, if you had one or two. Or
it also opens up the door for special interest groups to come in and say, well, I want this unit to be this and I want this unit to be that. And, you know, again, that complicates things a whole lot at that point. So.
Got a question for you. How long has this 20-20-60 split with the weapons been there?
It hasn't been there on general season. That's how we do our limited entry currently.
Mm-hmm.
But with general season, the way it has been is 16,000 permits out of the 97, so roughly 20% or 18% were archery.
Mm-hmm.
And then the muzzleloader and rifle actually came out of the same pool. And it ended up being around 11,000 muzzleloaders, and the rest were rifle hunters. So it was close to that 60-20-20 split when you give people, well, pulling the archers aside, give people their choice. So, you know, that's kind of where we came up with this split. It's based on what reality is currently.
Anise, doesn't this 60-20-20 split actually move a few hunters into archery and muzzle
loader? It does. Yeah.
Because I think our original split years ago was...
It is a little heavier on rifle.
Different.
Yeah.
And that was my next question.
Because we only... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
We only have 16,000 archers now.
Right.
So this actually does move a few more into archery.
Well, 16,000 is roughly, you know, 17% or 18%.
Yeah.
So it goes up a little bit.
So it's already moved that
right.
direction.
Right. Archers are actually not going to lose a whole lot of permit under this right. scenario. We actually have moved permits into archery given the 60-20-20 split.
And this 60-20-20 spread at this point is our recommendation.
Yeah,
the
exactly.
board could do something right. different if they wanted, but it
correct.
It does help with consistency so that the hunting public knows, you know, for the most part at least, that it's right. consistent around the state, so when they apply for a tag in that unit.
Yeah.
So I think the public would like to see that consistency too.
Yeah, and this is, like Jim mentioned, this is our recommendation, and we haven't recommended it yet because we're not setting permits, obviously. We will recommend that, but this we wanted to give you kind of a feel of what it will look like. Again, it doesn't have to be this split. We can cut the pie. However, I mean, archers are going to harvest. It's not like we could just put permits in archery and they're not going to harvest. They do seem to harvest at about half the rate of rifle hunters.
The last couple of years, I know we keep track of that. What was the, I can't remember the last meeting we went to. What's their success rate?
Success rate's about 18% on archery for the general season. And then the rifle varies so much because some units are different than others, but it goes from 25 to 50 on some units. So,
what were your permit numbers 20 years ago? How many archers, how many rifle? I know there was a lot more permits total.
20 years ago?
Yeah. What?
I think in 94 is when we set...
Pick your weapon?
94 is when we set... The current system, and that's how it's been
until
since
then. You got a permit and you could hunt from August
Jim
to
could probably
whenever.
Speak to that more than I can.
Prior to 94, we were around 200,000 rifle hunters.
Yeah, you sold a whole lot more permits back then,
right? And we didn't split up the permits by weapon type. Mm-hmm. You could also hunt archery,
And you bought a permit and you could hunt whatever weapon you wanted.
Yeah.
Within the season dates.
Yeah.
You didn't have to buy an archery permit or a rifle permit.
It's actually not quite that simple, but it's close because we changed. There was a couple, 3 years of evolution in there, but we had anywhere from 200,000 to 240,000 rifle hunters, and then we had, I can't remember the number of archers and muzzleloaders on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
But we had
a lot bigger deer herd to hunt from too back then.
Yeah,
theoretically,
but success rates were similar, and buck doe ratios were much lower those years.
We had lower buck doe ratio, but there were just more everywhere.
A lot more deer, much lower buck doe ratio. I actually presented that to the board 2 years ago. I showed some information from the early 80s versus today.
Mm-hmm.
I could dredge that up again if you're interested.
And that was my next question, though, was back in the early 80s. And that's probably before a lot of you guys were working here. Mm-hmm. But I remember deer hunting with my family back in the 70s and 80s. And yeah, there were hundreds of thousands of permits sold. But then there were hundreds of thousands of deer.
Right.
And you never shot a 2-point because you always had a 3 or a 4-point to take care of.
Sure.
So I was just wondering where, and I guess that's the $64 question, what happened and how do we get back there?
Well, you could get back there by having more permits, but you're going to have lower buck doe ratios as well. I mean,
right.
Those are the trade-offs. More permits mean lower buck doe ratios. So, yeah, you could have more hunters, no doubt about it. It wouldn't harm the population growth at all, but people will be dissatisfied because they're not seeing as many bucks.
Has the division ever looked at other weapon types like flintlock, crossbow, handgun, other types of weapons that might have lower success ratios where you could put more hunters in the field and create more opportunity?
Yeah, at one time we did a presentation to the board about having a totally primitive weapon type hunt, which involved flintlocks and longbows. Some states have Wyoming has no accommodation for muzzleloaders, as I remember. But we could give you that information again. But over time, it's safe to say that those weapon types have really evolved, and they're way more effective than they used to be. 30 years ago, muzzleloader rifle was way different than it is today, and success rates were way lower. So, and same with archery equipment. Archery success used to be down in the single digits, but now with real fancy compound bows, they're quite a bit higher, even though we have less deer.
And what needs to be kept in mind, too, is there are only so many days in the season. So unless you pick specific units where you have these type of things, I mean, then that leads to complication again, and you know, so you're going to have hunters that are confused, think they can use a regular muzzleloader in this unit, but no, it's a primitive muzzleloader only. And the hard part about going all the way back to a primitive muzzleloader is people have, put a lot of money into the equipment they have now, and you're going to have an outcry for those people that already have the equipment having to go buy a flintlock or whatever. So it's not just we just do it and it happens. There's social ramifications and law enforcement ramifications and everything like that. So, I mean, we've thought about it, but it's just not something that can be done very easily.
20, 30 years ago, did we know when we were issuing, hundreds of thousands of permits, do we know how many people were hunting with bows? I mean, it was, you didn't have to buy a bow permit.
We've got all that information.
Were there as many, the percentage of bow hunters, was there that many percentage, or were they less?
I don't have that information on top of my head. I can get it for you for sure. It's all there. I mean, we got very good.
You've got records back.
Oh, yeah.
Way back.
Back to 1925.
I was just at a cattleman's meeting up the street, and I asked a guy sitting next to me that lives down in, Sand Peak County, you know, what's happening to the deer herd? Why are we seeing the deer herds disappear? And he says, well, good grief, we start harassing them the 1st of August and we don't quit till the 1st of January. And he says, as a kid, I would go up on Manti on the Skyline Drive and you'd see a lot, hundreds of deer. And he says, you go up there now on the 4th of July and you see one or two that are all down the farmer's fields because they're harassed so much. they leave the mountains and they go down to the fields, and then you're in somebody's farm. Well, then he says we're killing them on the roads, which there's a fair amount of mortality, and then they're in some guy's field and he's not going to let you go hunt them.
There's lots of reasons we have fewer deer, and probably hunting is the lowest on that poll of why we have fewer deer. I don't think hunting is as big
well. I understand hunting as in I'm going to kill an animal and take it.
Right. Or hunting pursuing.
Or the pursuit.
Yeah, the pursuit.
And there were several guys that said, I kind of agree, and maybe it's a combination of everything together, but he was concerned that we're putting a lot of pressure on these poor guys.
Yeah, but I mean, they're a prey animal. They're being chased all the time, whether mm-hmm. we're chasing them and whether we're not. So I guess I don't buy into that theory of that. Because we're hunting them for so long, there's fewer of them.
And maybe that's not the only reason.
Right.
But maybe that's a piece of the pie.
It could be a piece of the pie.
I'm just guessing, and that's dangerous, but I'm guessing that total hunter days was much higher years ago than it is today.
Yeah.
For one reason, we had longer seasons. We had 11-day deer season, and we had way more hunters. So if you multiply the days by the hunters,
yeah.
we're not hunting them that hard. What we are hunting now... And we've always had an archery rifle and muzzleloader season of some sort for a long time. But we have a lot of elk hunts interspersed in there now. So there's more people on the mountain for a longer period of time. By the time you add a limited entry elk hunt, which has way more hunters than it used to. Well, we didn't even used to have one to any extent. And then all of the other seasons and antlerless elk permits, we do have a lot of people on the mountain for a long period of time.
And I should
whether
say
it's
that
really
all...
moving animals or not, I'm with Anise. I kind of doubt it because we've had heavy hunting pressure before. This isn't new, but
and
it
maybe
was
it's
for
the
shorter
fact,
periods of time.
And maybe it's the fact it's not just hunting, but it's just pressure from the general public.
Could be.
I mean, 20, 30 years ago, nobody had a four-wheeler. Very few had a motorcycle. If you had access to a horse, you went in the mountains and rode up there. Otherwise, you didn't go to the mountains that often. And now everybody and their dog literally has a four-wheeler, and they're up in the mountains all the time, and maybe that's the pressure that they're getting. It's not hunting pressure. Sure. It's just pressure from the general public, and it's putting a lot of pressure on them, and
That's certainly a piece of it. I wouldn't disagree with you, but I don't think it's affecting survival of the animals. We just don't see it in the data, at least adult animals. So the issue we're having with our mule deer is we're having a hard time getting fawns from 0 to 1 year old. And that's why our population is not growing. And that has nothing to do with harassing them or whatever. And maybe that
harassment put just enough pressure on them that they don't survive. I don't know.
It's hard. That's a hard one to answer.
Wouldn't we be able to kind of look at units like you mentioned before, easy access, you know, roaded units as opposed to units where there's not that
sure.
much access?
Yeah, and it's across the board, too. It's on units where we have a lot of high hunter pressure, and it's on units where we have almost zero hunting pressure. So
still
it's not
a hard time getting the phones.
Yeah, it's right. If you look at the data, it's not a pressure issue. There's forage issues, drought issues, disease issues. There's a lot of things playing into it. And sure, if they're moving more than they naturally would, they're going to use some energy, and that's not going to go into baby making. So there's a lot of things. And I'm not discounting that as being one of them, but I don't know if it's the biggest one.
It's certainly a factor to consider because that did not used to be there.
Right, but and I don't know how you control that.
Right.
Other than you lock the gate at the bottom of the canyon and say you can't go up there until hunting season.
Yeah,
you can't take your four-wheeler up there, you can't walk up there, you can't do anything.
We've done some of it too, you know, the amount of preseason scouting that's going on now, especially for elk, didn't exist.
Sure.
20, 25 years ago, and so there is way more activity and way more pressure on the mountain. What we don't know is if that's affecting the deer herd. It certainly could be, but we don't really have any evidence that it is.
Right.
And it's definitely on that list. It's just that we have other concerns that we think are way higher on that list, like habitat, predator control, highway mortality, that really are so much bigger than hunting pressure that mm-hmm. we're focused at those higher priorities.
Well, and how do you control the hunting pressure either? like I say, and there are places, yes, you can close the gate and take some of that pressure off, but you can't do it everywhere. I realize that.
Yeah, just to add a little bit to that conversation, if you take a unit like the Book Cliffs, mm-hmm. that doesn't have a lot of the camping pressure, it has other pressure, and maybe it's not a good comparison because you've got a lot of oil and gas type disturbance up there, but it doesn't, you know, there aren't any developed campgrounds
There are no four-wheelers up there either.
not near as many four-wheelers, and compare that to a place like the Manti where you have all that. We don't see different fond-à-dos ratios on the Book Cliffs than we do on the Manti, where one has
still that, very similar in your ratios.
Yeah, where one has a lot of, or the Wasatch, where you have places where you have a lot of campgrounds, a lot of four-wheelers, a lot of summer recreation pressure versus the Book Cliffs where you have very little. We're not seeing a big difference. And maybe there's other examples that are better than that. That's the one that comes to my mind.
That's a good one, yeah. And there's quite a few like that. And it's similar to the Henry Mountains. I mean,
right, same. You get the same thing. You don't have the pressure down there.
Right.
Let me just add one thing, Kevin, because I live out in the Northeast. That Book Cliffs, you know. Yes, I think there's more. You know, in the Forest Service, you got to move your camper every 2 weeks or every 16 days up on the mountain. People haul those trailers up there quick as the road drawn up to let them pull in there. Then every 2 weeks they move that trailer. And they're up there literally all summer long. So that has got to be a part of it. But I'm just here to say there's a lot of going on. More camping than we might think out on that Book Cliffs. Although people right now are a little bit scared because of the bears, because they seem to come into your trailer or your pickup or whatever every time you leave it for a day or two.
Yeah, and that, as I thought about it, and the oil and gas development, all the trucks on those
huge.
Roads is way different. But but still, in terms of the camping pressure, it's way different than Red Cloud Loop or some of the other places where you have a lot of developed campgrounds.
Right,
and a lot of
Red Cloud would have a lot more than we do out there.
I got a question for you too, Kevin. You may not want to run off too far. You're kind of a predator guy. Years and years and years ago, when I was, you guys were all probably middle-aged, and I was pretty young.
I probably wasn't born yet.
But
we had.
Anyway, there was a lot more sheep and livestock on the country that I hunt now. There was more government trappers. There was 1080. There was cyanide guns. And with the sheep and the livestock, the range was different. The predator situation, the predators had a lot more constant pressure on them. All that has to be a factor in what's happening to the deer here now. I mean, there's fires, you know, what used to be brush is now grass. I mean, all that stuff has to.
What used to be aspen is now conifers. There's, and that's just the problem, John. There's so many factors, predation, habitat, recreational pressure, weather conditions, you know, they're just, that's what makes mule deer management so frustrating. And Anise can speak to this better than I can, is there's just, you can't put your finger on one thing and say, if we fix that, we'll fix it. Because, and we're trying, you know, we're working on highway mortality. We're working on habitat restoration. We're doing more on predators than anybody in the West. And so we're trying to take that multi-prong approach in Utah. And that's paying off. You know, Jim can speak to this better than I can, but even though our deer populations aren't what we want them to be, they're at least we've stopped the downward trend, whereas a lot of the Western states are still in that downward trend because they're not doing trying to address all the different factors like we are.
I guess the point I'm making, and kind of listen to Calvin talk, when I think back of the numbers of deer and listening to my dad talk about what used to be in the pictures, all the, you know, the pickup trucks loaded with huge deer and stuff, like literally everything is different. The range is different. The predator situation is different. The livestock's different. Almost everything, the highways, everything
we're dealing with
is different than it was 20 years ago.
Certainly.
So to compare what was and what is, we're playing on a totally different field.
And the fact that you could graze, the number of cattle and sheep and all those, tells you that the habitat was a lot different as well. I mean, you couldn't sustain that same number of sheep and cattle and all that on the range as it exists today. So there were, I mean, habitat is where it ultimately comes down to. All the other ones do play into it, take bites out of that pie, but if you can't have enough habitat, you're not going to have enough mule deer. And sure, there were sheep on the landscape, so predators were being controlled, and it also had sheep to eat as well. So, you know, there were a lot of things that were different. And I don't know if we can go back to those days where you could have that many sheep on the mountain and that many cattle and that many deer. We're certainly trying to rehabilitate all the habitat, but it's just, you know, you're working against successional things, and it's not an easy battle, and I think we're waging as good as a battle as anyone in the West as far as mule deer.
Well, I think we're definitely doing everything we can do, which whether it works or not, I mean, that's our obligation to do everything.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
But it's just amazing, you know, when you think about it, how different everything is from...
Are we educating the public enough to what's going on? Because I hear a lot of people say the division knows how to do everything but manage wildlife.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you hear that, but I hear that, and it's not just ranchers. Are we educating people? Are we educating the hunters to know that, you know, the reason we're cutting the permits is because, you know, 20 years ago, Utah's population was at 1 million. Now we're at 2 million. There's twice as many people out there to go around.
Yeah,
do they know that it's a combination of everything? It's not just the fact that you guys are idiots and you don't know how to manage wildlife.
I think those that want to be educated, we're providing the information. It's really hard to reach those that don't want to be educated, and maybe we could be doing a better job to try to reach them, because there are those who just, you know, like you said, think we're all a bunch of knuckle draggers and don't know what we're doing.
Like I say, I'm not in that group. I'm just telling you. Yeah, I hear a lot that you guys know how to do everything,
but they're not. And those.
And you probably hear it too.
Oh yeah, on a
daily
basis.
Calvin, I think if they would just take 1 minute and look at our website, the first thing they see is what is the division doing for mule deer, and if they click on that, there's an abundance of information. If they don't use the computer, we've done hundreds of news articles. We have a great new flyer on all that's being done for mule deer. And I think it really boils down to how much do people want to be informed. If they want to be informed, the information is there. We have distributed information in the last year, especially, to a greater extent than we ever have on all of the things that we're doing for deer. I sent an open letter last year to all of the sportsmen in the state outlining all of that. It immediately hit 20 places on the internet. I think for people, if they don't know what we're doing, they don't want to hear it.
They don't want to know.
Because it's out there. There's plenty of it there. Anybody that's listening to this, go to our website, front page, click on the deer. It's there.
In addition to that, we've been hosting open houses throughout the state. Our regions have, trying to bring people in, and just with that exact purpose in mind, to try to educate them and try to give them a more one-on-one experience with our biologists to answer their questions and help them understand, which is hard to do in a public meeting setting through the racks and the board. So those are being pretty successful in some places and not so well attended in others.
I was going to say, you look at the numbers of people that show up to your racks versus the amount of hunters that are there.
It's a drop in the bucket of even.
Oh, yeah. It's nothing.
I agree
with you. Nobody will come to here. All I want to do is get the permit and be like it was when they were a kid when they went with granddad and come home with a truckload of deer.
And the reality of human nature, we like to complain. And so there's going to be people that complain.
That's true.
Speak for yourself, Anise.
Yeah. Anise, I am speaking for myself. Let me say one thing, Anise. We've taken quite a while on this. We just want to bring the new board up. But look, I really, really appreciate this chart that you gave us, you know, and that's based on a population of 280, it looks like to me. And I just want to, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but I want the board to understand this. It appears to me that as we change plus or minus 1 buck per 100 does, if it's 19 and below, we're about 5,500 tags per every one buck per 100 does. If we go above that, it's about 3,500 to 4,000 tags. So I think that we as a board need to understand that.
Right.
Because incrementally, you know, what is the difference between 17 and 18?
Right.
It's not as much difference as it is between 15 and 18. So we need to understand that. And am I right in the interpretation of
you,
that?
You are, yeah. It's not a linear relationship. If you look at the graph on the back, it kind of shows it that it's kind of curving up, which means that every little bit you're actually, it's not a straight relationship. So, yeah, the more bucks you try to keep, the even more cuts you have to have.
The higher that number, the more the cuts have to be.
Right.
So what you're saying then, Dale, if I'm reading you right, if we went to 17 from 18, we're saving 5,500 tags.
Yeah.
I mean, by moving at one number, we're saving almost half of what we'd have to cut.
Yeah. Just think about it. Our limited entry, which is really good hunting, is 25. So right now, that's the top end on our general season as well. So, you know, it's quite a cut you have to make to get to 25. So, anyway.
And the other implication is the current plan, we don't increase one permit anywhere in the state until the unit gets to limited entry status,
right.
25.
Exactly. The biggest problem with the current buck-doe ratio, in my mind, is the top end, not the bottom end.
Agreed.
Because it doesn't allow us to add permits until we get to limited entry status.
And that's 25.
That's 25.
Correct.
And I think the board really needs to think about that number. That number's could really be problematic down the road.
If
what does the population estimates look like when you get to that point? Is it still at 280 if every unit in the state is at 25 bucks per 100 does? Is that still part of the model?
Yeah. When you're in that range between 15 and 25 buck to doe ratios, really you don't see any difference in the trajectory of the population because, you know, that's mostly based on production. And production can vary on a lot of different factors that have nothing to do with buck to doe ratio. So, yeah, it doesn't change a whole lot as far as production goes.
So let me ask one other follow-up question to that. If there was a change and you said, let's make it now rather than 1 year from now or whatever, between you and Jim and everybody else in the DWR, what would that bottom line be? Would it go to 15, 17, 18? I don't understand what you're saying,
yeah,
and
it
I
just
pretty
depends.
Much agree with you.
Sure. It depends what you want to manage for. I mean, if you want to manage for, you know, average hunting where every guy can go out and relatively has a good opportunity to harvest a yearling or 2 or 3 year old, you know, 15 is a good number, and that probably maximizes opportunity without having too few bucks. If you fall below 15, obviously it's not going to be as good a hunting. It's just there going to be fewer bucks out there. You know, 18 gets to be pretty good hunting. I mean, anybody who hunts and after the season, if there are 18 bucks per 100 does left, that's what people consider, you know, fairly good. It's not limited entry hunting where you're passing up bucks. So, I mean, anywhere between 15 and 18, I think we could live with. Obviously, if we want to maximize opportunity, we want to be at the 15 range. If we want a little bit better quality, we want to be at the 18 range. So, and then the top end is kind of where, you know, you want to have a smaller range. So if we're managing for 15 bucks per 100 does at the low end, the top end shouldn't be higher than 17. So you could actually increase permits when you get above 17 and keep it down in there. And if you start at 18, you probably shouldn't have a high range of above 18 just because it gives you opportunity to increase.
And that's a good point for the board. I think that you don't want too big of a range.
Right.
When you set the number, pick it, but don't have too big of a range.
Right.
We don't necessarily need a one standard fits all for all general season hunting either. Maybe two ranges, two smaller ranges providing two types of hunting. Clearly, when we got our inputs through the racks and through the 900 emails or whatever it was, there's a split in the public on this thing. So My only hang up is that we resolved the public split by setting one standard for the whole state for general season, which I don't think really reflects the split in what our sportsmen want or the biology and other things.
Yeah, we certainly could go with separate ranges on separate units, as long as we're not, having four or five different ranges. And, you know, we still want to maintain some, just so we're not jumbled all over the place. And then everybody can go and pick their own unit that they like and want this objective on that one. And it needs to be set in a good way that makes it.
Let me ask you this then, and go back to South Slope Vernal, because that's where I'm from. And mm-hmm. It's what, 11, 12 bucks per 100. Sure. And if we go to 15 to 18 or 15 to 17, we're still going to be under objective for a while there.
Sure. Yeah, you'd have to cut permits to get up there.
You're going to have to cut permits to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple others, Monroe, and some of them are like that.
Yeah.
That are very low.
Right. And those you may have to cut permits in half to actually get up to that objective, and may need to maintain them even lower to maintain that, just because they're, the Monroe specifically is a very accessible unit, so bucks are more vulnerable to harvest. So it's one where you may have to hold permits low to even maintain 15 or 18 bucks per 100 does.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, can I say a few words? First of all, in response to Jim's, first thing you see on the computer is a dead doe in a highway. And then you see all the other things. One of the reasons I liked to go unit by unit was there were so many options and things that we could do with each unit. And all that's been discussed by everybody here today. And 2 years from now, we'll know which ways we need to go on a lot of the units. If you look at the Monroe, you look at the Boulder, they're both under objective. The Fish Lake's probably going to fall in there this year. I'm almost 99%. There's something going on in that area that's we're not getting any fawn recruitment. Also, it's one of the major areas in the state of Utah where we have the highest ATV use. There's tons and tons of different things that are happening. My question is, a year ago when we got through with the unit by unit, I and Tom and some of the others addressed, when are we going to look at our unit by unit management plans for each one of those so that we can address those individually with our county commissioners, our state road people, farmers, and things like that. Is that coming on soon, or are we going to wait another year, or what's going on?
The units are due this April for review. Usually our deer plants don't go through county commissioners or those type of things, so I'm not sure that is going to happen.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is there's many more people in each one of those units that can identify problems with farmers and ranchers and other areas that maybe a division people doesn't see. If we open that up to the community like you did with your when you traveled around the state and tried to identify, or you was telling what you were doing with deer management plans and things like that, you're going to have people come in there and they're going to tell you where the deer problems are.
Right.
And I guess I think that needs to be addressed.
Well, I agree it does. And to get public input that way. But I don't know if the unit plans is the place where that input comes in, because unit plans are not, we're not basically setting specific, we're setting objectives for populations, which are going to be based on what the biologist thinks those populations' objectives should be. Where we deal with a lot of the issues you're talking about a lot of times is in the statewide plan, how we're going to deal with the specific.
Well, and I think that those have to be dealt individually, because a hole in the fence on I-70 that doesn't get fixed for 6 months because somebody hasn't reported it, taken care of it, and pretty soon you got 10 or 12 deer in one spot that's dead.
Sure.
Let me just point out, that's why we have regional advisory councils, and that's why they're structured the way they are. They have elected representatives. They have farmers, ranchers, sportsmen, a wide variety, our at-large people, a wide variety of people to represent the varied interests locally, and every management plan has to go through that local review. And if RAC members aren't reaching out to their constituents, those RACs were very specifically designed to have people from special interest groups so that those special interest groups could reach out to their constituents locally and represent them. We obviously can't have everybody, but regional advisory councils are big, they're diverse, and this is why they were designed, is for review of management plans like this, and they need to get deeply involved in the review of these plans.
So are those coming up again soon or not?
In the spring.
Yeah. April. Yeah. Yeah, and one thing you mentioned is maybe along with that, or even separate from that, the region should be having maybe some kind of meeting to discuss what are some of the problems on these units, not specifically to deal with the unit plans, because unit plans, you know, don't address a lot of the things you just talked about. They basically set objectives for populations and those kind of things. They're not that detailed of if there's a hole in the fence on I-70 or that. Those, I think, have to be dealt with separately on a regional basis, on a unit-by-unit basis, by the local biologist meeting with the local folks in that area.
And that's exactly what I'd like to get accomplished on some of the areas. Just in what I travel, I've cut like 6 fawns out of the fence in the last 6 months. And I pass that along, but nothing gets done. But if we have a whole group of people in that whole county or whatever that can address some of those problems,
yeah,
then we can lower the fence in that area or get the battery fixed on the sign that's on Highway 89 that's been off for 2 years. You know?
And I agree with you. That needs to happen.
Just one more question, Mr. Chairman, then I'll leave it alone. Anise, it seemed like in the past the $15 per 100 doe always kind of scared me on a regional basis. It seemed really low because a couple units would be quite low, and then there might be a unit that was doing really well.
Right.
And one unit's success almost worked to the demise of the others, yeah, because it just kept a status quo.
Sure.
Now that we're unit by unit, if we were at 15 or 16 or 17 and could actually cut permits and target that number,
sure,
we should see quite a improvement across the board, not and be able to actually deal with some of those,
yeah,
units.
Oh,
and,
for
and,
sure. I mean, managing unit by unit is the only way you can really target those units that are falling below. And even when we were regional hunting, we said if they get to a certain point, we would pull them out.
So we're not, yeah, that's one thing I've tried to, I'm having a hard time, I guess, wrapping my mind around, is we're not dealing with a regional average anymore, that when we,
yeah,
target that number, we're actually targeting that number.
Right, that unit, yeah.
That's the success we're going to reach. So.
Yeah, I mean, we can manage any unit for any buck doe ratio by cutting permits. That's just, you can do it. It's not unreachable. It's just, you're right, when you had a regional average, there could have been units that were 20 and units that were 13, and, you know, you were
nothing
still
ever
able,
changed because,
yeah,
they all kind of,
yeah,
hung on the average. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just add one thing. I know we've been over an hour on this and we need to move on, but I'd be derelict in my duties as director if I didn't mention this. And I know people hate to hear this because they think the division is too concerned about money. But I want to put a money aspect to this. For the first time now in the history of the Division of Wildlife, we will have tied our revenue to buck doe ratios. Deer permits are still our biggest source of revenue in the state. It's right up there with fishing licenses. And now our revenue is going to fluctuate with buck doe ratios. That's going to make it very hard for this agency to have a sustainable budget into the future that we can count in on year in and year out. What we're going to have to do is manage for the worst case scenarios. And what that means is we're going to have fewer game wardens, fewer biologists, fewer habitat work, less predator control, all of that. Don't expect to find a game warden once we start cutting game wardens when you need him. we just won't have the budget to do it. When we tied our, when we are now tying our budget to buck-doe ratios, and if we can't get those buck-doe ratios up, the division budget's going to go down pretty rapidly. And we've already made cuts. I want everybody to hear this once again. We cut $3.5 million and 25 people out of our budget this year. Since that time, we've got more bad news about further loss of revenue, and it's a serious problem. You're just not going to have the same size Division of Wildlife and the level of service, and I just want people to be aware of that now that we've tied it to buck-doe ratios and we've set up the bar pretty high for ourselves. And there are going to be years when we have bad winters or extensive droughts. We're not going to hit 18 bucks per 100 does, and it's going to be really difficult to sustain a budget. You cannot run an agency with hire them and fire them. We cannot hire people in the good years and let them go in the bad years. So we will be forced to manage for the worst years, for the revenue that we received on the worst years. And that will mean a much smaller agency delivering less service to the sportsman. And in my opinion, and time's running out for me to make this point, that's not good for wildlife. It's not good for wildlife. And if it's not good for wildlife, it's not good for hunters. And so just want you to be aware of that. We, in our fever to improve the quality of hunting, we've now tied our budget to buck-doe ratios.
What's a deer permit? What's the cost of a deer permit?
It's 35
plus what? The $26 base license.
What's the limit that a hunter will say, you know what, it's not worth the expense? Is there a limit? Do we know that?
There is always a point where
if you raise it $5, yes, somebody's going to fall out.
Yes, and every time
you raise it $500, somebody, I don't care what it is, I'm still going to buy it.
Yeah, and every time you do a license increase, we do that analysis. You reach a point of diminishing returns. We especially see that with fishing licenses. It's especially sensitive to that. If you raise it too high, people drop off by the thousands.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with hunters, we have way more demand than we have supply. And so you can cut a little, and there'll still be people there to take those tags.
You can add $10, and they'll yes, still buy a permit. There'll be a certain number that, you know what, that was the straw. I'm not gonna pay that.
Yeah. That does occur.
That's the balancing act that you always have to have.
Yes, it is.
What will they pay?
Yes, it is.
What's the question for the director then? Where's the happy medium where we can see a marked improvement in our quality that people have asked for, yet not gut our agency and put ourselves at such a financial disadvantage that we're...
What we really need is more deer, and we're working feverishly to do that. We've set the bar pretty high for ourselves now on buck-doe ratios, and we've not given ourselves any flexibility. We said it'll be this on every unit, even though on some units I think the public would rather have the opportunity to hunt rather than three more bucks per 100 does. So as you look at this exponential graph, just be aware, every time you move that a buck or two, thousands of people go out the door and hundreds of thousands of revenue. The revenue that we lost associated with this year's cuts was, where's Greg, around $700,000.
And it
impacts us tremendously. So
on the committee, we went through this exercise, and that's why they didn't decide to go up from 15. Because we told them how many people we would be dropping, and the committee as a whole felt like that wasn't doable, and that's why it wasn't set any
higher. What the division would like to see is a little bit of flexibility and less rigidity on the same standard on every unit. It'd be nice to give us that flexibility. We'd be glad to bring you back a dual set of recommendations for permit numbers this spring that has some flexibility in it, but it requires amending the deer plan in order to accept that. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if we had, is the division and I'm asking whoever's equipped to answer this, which I'm assuming is one of you two. Is the division comfortable with 15 as the floor on all units?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I mean, to have any kind of resemblance of good hunting, I think if you go below 15, it gets pretty hard to find a pretty good, you know.
So you could bring us back a set of options with 15 as the floor. So, I think it'd be real hard to sell anything below 15
I agree,
to anybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe some, you know, units at 15, some at 17 or 18 or whatever you decide.
And if the top end of that ratio wasn't as high, we could probably move some of those tags to other units rather than eliminate tags.
What would be your, just kind of shooting from the hip here, what would be your, if 15 is the floor on a general season hunt, what would be your ceiling?
An ace,
20,
give them your numbers.
19,
15 to 17 would be a good range for the lower end. And then if you want to have a higher end unit, 18 to 20.
Jim, could we also do, and I'm open to that, and that's why I like unit by unit, but could we do also maybe one trade-off and add one additional year for study as part of that rather than 2000? Was it 14 or 13 that you was looking at in May?
Yeah, it'll be, well, it's due in 14, May 2014.
Well, this is another revision of the DARE plan. Have we revised it every year in ACE or just
we have.
4 out of 5?
No, we've revised it every year so far.
Yeah.
Got it.
I mean, we can revise that plan anytime you want. What I'd like to see is some discipline to stick to it.
Yeah.
For more than a year.
But.
Well, if that's the case, then that's where we're at.
What? Me?
The wizard has spoken. Use the microphone.
Why don't you get those ones that clip on our shirts?
Like those. You can't hide from those.
Okay. Yeah. We need to move on. I want to try to close this out, so if anybody got a better idea, help me here. But I think we're getting from the board a little bit of education, and I appreciate that. And I think that in the near future, and the board needs to make some reconsideration to give some flexibility to the DWR so that we don't lose those dollars, but we're still trying to take care of the deer. We're doing it on a unit-by-unit basis. So I'm not going to put anything out there. I just think that you men here know when's best and when you can gather the data that give us information that will allow us to make an educated motion and decision. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes. Comfortable with that, Jim?
Go for a
yeah.
That'd be fine. We can't act on it here today, and
no, we can't.
But you can make it a. You can act on it tomorrow during the big game proclamation. I don't think you can amend the plan, but you could give the direction to the division of where you'd like to see that plan go when we come back with permit numbers in the spring.
Yeah, I'd just like to see some options and the financial and permit number results of, you know, certain buck doe ratios and maybe what we might be able to work with, just to kind of get an idea and start
looking
that way.
You could extrapolate that if you just take this chart that Anise has provided and just simply say $50 per permit. You're going to be in the ballpark, or $60 per permit. You could get some dollar figures, and you could get some numbers of opportunity and whatever. Is that not right?
Well, in the spring, if you just, for example, a scenario, if you gave us direction tomorrow to come back with dual recommendations in the spring that allow some flexibility, we can accommodate that all right, can't we, Anise?
Yeah, we certainly could.
It's a starting point, you know. Yeah. So.
And in the meantime, we can take a look at it unit by unit. Anise already has some good ideas about which types of units ought to be in each category. He's already thought his way all through all this, and come back with a second recommendation, second set of recommendations.
Okay. Thank you all. Thank you, Anise. Appreciate you. Let's move on to the second item. Private Landowner Programs, Boyd Blackwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am here to address an action log item that was requested of us to take a look at landowner permit opportunities, more specifically with New Mexico's E-System and Utah's Landowner Association System. And you all have a handout that I placed on your packets, and then there's a couple extra here. In going over this, a good system needs to be flexible and provide incentives to landowners to allow wildlife on their property, provide an economic benefit, and one that's biologically sound and can be effective through a sports hunting system. This is the way that we prefer to manage our wildlife is through hunting. The two systems, New Mexico's has two systems, both for elk and pronghorn. And Utah has basically one system for deer, elk, and pronghorn. The number of vouchers that are determined for both systems for in New Mexico and Utah is based basically upon the amount of elk habitat on a given unit and the number of available public permits. So that what they do is they take the number of permits for that landowner association or that specific system, and it comes off of the top of what's available to the public. And in New Mexico's system, you're not allowed to, they don't provide assistance in depredation if you participate in the program. If you request depredation assistance, you're removed from the program and you're given one or the other. Here in Utah, we will provide antlerless vouchers to landowners that are having problems with elk or deer or pronghorn. And if their damages come to more than the value of those permits, we also will pay for damages as well. Now, the big thing is that the vouchers are provided in the E-System from the program, and it's completely managed by their fish and game department, and they track the number of ranches, who gets what, one permit or two permits or no permits. They have a drawing for any property that can't equal one whole permit. So they have a drawing for those that are below that. So you may get a permit, you may not, depending upon their drawing. In Utah's, we provide the vouchers to the Landowner Association chairman, and that chairman distributes the permit according to the distribution plan that they give us annually. So we are able to get a distribution plan, and that even somebody with 5 acres, he may not qualify for one permit 1 year, but he may qualify for a permit depending on their bylaws. In 2 years or 3 years, depending on what their bylaws have for each individual association. In the New Mexico system, the vouchers are predetermined as to whether they can be used on a unit-wide basis or a ranch-specific basis. And in Utah's, the vouchers are good on the entire unit unless they request a variance, and that gets into a whole different scenario of when and where these vouchers can be used and how. One of the things with the system is that New Mexico's has a heavy workload. It's very expensive to manage, and they have two full-time FTEs just for the administration of the program, and then they work with 15 or more biologists. So if there's a heavy workload in this, that these two full-time FTEs are totally specifically dedicated to the E program. In Utah, it takes about a 16th of one FTE, and that includes the work of the biologists, because most of the heavy lifting, most of the work, the administration, comes through landowner association chairmen and specific committees. So they handle most all of their own. They just provide, make sure that they provide us with permit distribution, and then we have our way of calculating the number of permits that each association is allotted. Our recommendation would be, of course, is to continue with the current program. It's simple, it's cost efficient, and it's fair. Small landowners can get a permit, just probably not as much as the big landowners. It totally depends upon on how they work it within each association. Vouchers, the number of vouchers given to each association, we've gone over twice in the last 3 years, once as an action log item, and we sent that request to look at that to the CWMU Advisory Committee, and they came back with a recommendation that we continue with the current methodology of determining permits and that we would stay with that. And so with that, I turn it back over to you, Mr. Chairman, for questions.
Any questions from the board? Reminder, this is just informational items.
I would ask, we've also got a huge amount of landowner programs through walk-in access, CWMUs, and others. New Mexico got anything new and different?
No, I would say their closest thing that they try to emulate over there is our CWMU program with their e-program. But we have the CWMU program and the Landowner Association program, and as you stated, walk-in access. So Utah is I don't know if I were on the cutting edge of this kind of effort of involving public, giving public opportunity, and also providing assistance and incentives to landowners.
Thank you.
I have just one quick question. It's a question I have for just about everything. Is there a good place to go, and maybe it's on the website, I haven't looked closely enough, that we could take a look at the documents that you have that explain the landowner program, the whole thing? That's my big issue, or not an issue, but my problem with a lot of things is I don't have a lot of background information on these things, and a lot of them are very complex. And so if I were to want to read the history of this or what exactly it is, what the guidelines are, the restrictions, those type of things, where would I go?
Yeah, Mr. King, the rule is on our website, so people would be able to go through the rule. That can be somewhat complicated, as you said. So we also have information pages on our website that people can get to, and we'll provide them with that information, as well as each regional office is able to provide information as well.
Okay, thanks.
Jake?
How do you come up with what you need to do to be eligible for an NRLS voucher? Or is that by complaints or?
Well, in most cases, to get a voucher for an antlerless animal, it would deal with complaints, issues, depredation issues. If you're having a depredation problem, the landowner specialist would go out, take a look, and determine, yes, we have a problem here, and we will give you a permit. Most of it comes from a call from a landowner, and there's lots out there that know of the program and know that they're available. In fact, I think pretty much everybody.
Is the majority of those one or five or multiple permits that you give at a time?
Yes. It's multiple vouchers or permits. A landowner can obtain up to five antlerless elk, two antlerless elk, five antlerless deer, five pronghorn, doe pronghorn permits for themselves to keep to make up for mitigation for damages. But we also provide landowners, if there's extra animals on the property and they're still causing damage, we'll provide them with voucher permits that they can turn around and sell to the public to have access to be able to get in and try to remove some of these problem animals as well.
Okay, this is a question maybe you can answer today, but maybe you could sometime in the future, and maybe it's even inappropriate. How many buck tags would it take to satisfy those people so we didn't have to kill those?
Well, one of the things you need to understand about that in that issue or that issue or that realm is that the damages are probably being caused by a majority of antlerless animals, and therefore the best way for us to handle that is going to be by removing those antlerless animals. However, we are looking at a system. There needs to be some sideboards on that so that we're not just giving out antlered permits whenever. But there would need to be a program developed and sideboards developed and looked at that. And we are addressing that, looking at that as an agency right now to see whether it would be feasible, how it would be feasible, and when it would be feasible.
Okay, that answers my question, and I think that's really good that you're looking at that option.
In addition, just jump in here. A lot of the times we are trying to control populations in those areas, so you would have to take antlerless animals to do that. And that's why we issue antlerless permits in a lot of instances instead of buck permits.
In a lot of those areas that are in my area, I also hear the comments from the landowners that they didn't draw out for a deer permit and they still want to hunt.
Well, now
so they give them for their family members or whatever, too.
Landowners, there is a program available that guarantees landowner a permit if they come in and apply for it. It's not a free permit. This is a permit that we would guarantee that they would be able to have if they have over 640 acres.
General season,
yes. And they'll be picking unit by unit that we've already figured and gone through that, so.
I guess I'd just like to say to Boyd that having a family that deals with a lot of private ground and stuff in other states and dealing with some landowner permits in other states and looking at the programs that we have here in Utah, I would agree with you that we are definitely on the cutting edge of dealing with landowners, dealing with depredation, and bringing landowners and public users, whether it's hunters or fishermen, together to maximize access and opportunity. I've always been very impressed with the job you're doing and with what the division's doing. I think we have it pretty good, and I think that's one thing that I hear Ernie talk a lot about, the walk-in access, and I think we're just making a lot of inroads and progress there. So I appreciate it. I appreciate the information, and I know I hear a lot and got the email about the depredation permits and things, but I think that personally, I think depredation permits go a long way in the agricultural community to keep a good relationship there. And I just think, I mean, nobody likes to shoot does if you don't have to. But I think see it as real positive. So I appreciate your efforts, and I think that the division's done a really good job there.
Are depredation payments, damage payments come out of that same program?
The Landowner Association?
Yeah.
No, we have a separate, there's a separate pot of money that our damage payments come from, but we still look at that and determine what their income was off of those permits, and then that'll come off of their damage payment.
So they can get those permits in addition to some damage?
Yes.
I'm going to say, because that was another concern that came up in the meeting previously, that they used to pay 100%, now they're down to 60%, and the pot's going to get less?
No, that's incorrect information. We always set it out at 100%. We pay 100% of damages.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we go over the amount that's allotted, then we will prorate. And we prorated this year for the first time at 80%. And so, yeah, they got 80% on the dollar this year, which was prorated. But we pay 100% of the damages when we don't go over that amount.
What's the amount that
It's $500,000. We set aside about $100,000.
Total?
Yeah.
So you have a $500,000 pot of money, and if it goes over that, then obviously you have to start scaling back.
Right. We prorate, yes.
But
it's an 80%, not a 60%, because I was told they were...
It was 85, wasn't it, Boyd?
Yeah, yeah, it was
85%.
Yeah, it was 85%.
We prorated at 85% for the first time, and we've submitted a building block for our budget to add another $200,000 to that, which should cover... most years. I won't say every year, but it...
Right. And that was a concern this year because...
Yeah, 60% is extremely inaccurate.
Okay.
The biggest difference in what we've paid is not the amount of damage. It's the cost of the crop.
Right. And that was the concern. You know, hay prices, commodities are extremely high priced right now, and so it puts even more strain on your budget.
Hay is really high this year,
right?
And you know, with as the director said, Director Karpowitz, that we have asked for a building block, which will increase that. That amount there also doesn't include the extra 110 to 20,000 that we've also put out there of materials on the ground to protect haystacks, to temporary protect.
To put in fencing, yep. to do what you can to keep them out.
Yeah.
So this money, this $500,000 and hopefully $200,000 more, is that general fund money that comes from the legislature? That's an allocation?
It's half general fund and half license dollars.
Okay.
There was a pretty good coalition of sportsmen and the Farm Bureau and Utah Farmers Union and others that got the last increase of general funds money in there 5 years ago, 6 years ago.
It's been $500,000 for many years, Ernie.
So is the additional $200,000, is that legislative allocated funds, or is that split 50-50 between license fees and...
We don't know how that'll shake out. So we'll just have to wait and see how that shows up in the governor's budget and then
what
the legislature does with it.
You're having to get permission to spend $200,000 more from the legislature?
Yes. We would at least like it to be the way the current split is, or perhaps... even more weighted on the general fund, but at least the current ratio.
As the director said, you know, we've had this amount for many years now. We've been able to keep up and make those payments, and in fact have a little bit extra. But over the last 5 years, the cost of things,
the prices
of gas
have crept up,
yeah.
And so it's just you have to pay more out because the crop's worth more.
Right. Yeah.
That's it. We'll move on.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Boyd. Next item is laser sighting device with Mike Fowkes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think this one will be fairly quick. This is in regards to action log item, that wanted the division to consider allowing blind hunters to use laser sighting device and a companion hunter in conjunction and then bring a recommendation to the board here. We looked at this. I spoke with Marty Bushman. I spoke with Kenny Johnson, who handles our hunting and fishing accommodations for folks with disabilities. And we believe that we could take a rule change out through the rack and board process. That's lengthy and time consuming. We believe we can do this with the rule and that we currently have on the books and with the Americans with Disabilities Act. The rule allows us to amend allows people to ask for an amendment to their COR. And with the Americans with Disabilities Act, that allows us to provide reasonable accommodation with the use of these laser sights for this specific issue. We're dealing with less than a dozen folks a year on average that use this companion hunting COR. We know who they are. We can identify them. We can notify them that if they'd like to do this, take this opportunity, they can just apply for that, and we can deal with it in-house. So I believe we can deal with this without going through the rack and board process.
Thank you. Comments? questions?
As I remember, one of the reasons was just a review of the safety considerations. So you came away okay?
Yeah, I've looked at the efficacy of the laser sights. It may provide them with an advantage, although I don't think it's going to provide them with a great advantage. And when we're dealing with less than a dozen, I think we're going to be okay.
And public safety too.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Mike. No other questions? Next item is, we'll skip that. 9 mile boundary range, Crick. Anise?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this was, again, another item that's on the action log. This unit, as you know, in the past has always been for elk, limited entry on the public land, but any bull on the private lands. And last year, we got direction from the board to try to go one way or the other, so it's not kind of the stepchild of the elk program. And I have Justin Shannon here from the region if you have questions for him, and he may want to comment as well. They met with local landowners on that area and also sportsmen that have great interest in hunting that area. And out of that, they came up with a recommendation to go to any bull on that entire unit instead of having it be one on, be any bull on private land and limited entry on public land. So with that, I provided you a map that kind of shows what the ownership is. The red is private land. The blue is state sections, and the green is public land. So I think, and then the black are the roads on those units. So it's just, I know you've received a letter from some of the landowners on that unit that are opposed to this. It did go through the RAC. There was some comment on it, but they did vote for it to be any bull during the RAC meeting as well. So.
This is an action item at this point for tomorrow, though, isn't it?
Well, it's an action item, but it's also on the action log, and we just want to say that our recommendation tomorrow, deals with the action log item.
Not an action item right now.
No.
And so, yeah.
Just refresh my memory, the area north and west of the red line there, is that currently any bull?
It is, yeah.
Part of the Range Creek.
That's, yeah. Range Creek North, yeah.
So, okay.
I got the...
And the landowners that sent the letter, where do they reside?
One of the landowners resides south of that boundary of Dry Creek or Dry Canyon, and the other ones reside north of that. And so
they're already in any bull.
Yeah, they're already in any bull, and the letter that they supported would go... have it all be limited entry up through the 9 mile canyon road south, both on private land and public land. So they're in any bull situation now, but they would like to be limited entry.
They want to change the current situation to limited entry.
Correct. Not only do they want to change the boundary north so that they would be included in that, but they also want to change the structure where it's limited entry on both public land and private land.
So. I wanted to point that out because that red line is not all of the Range Creek unit.
No.
Yeah, it's just the Range Creek South.
And it comes over here to the Soldier Creek Road.
Right. But for purposes of the action log discussion, which is kind of what we're doing today, we just asked that it go back to the region work, and bring back a solution. And we're going to actually get that one tomorrow, and we already know there's some public response and input to it.
Could I, Justin, before you go, I got the email with the Nutter Ranch letter, and I could not get it to open for some reason. I think Stacy corrupted the file when she sent it to me.
That's not surprising.
But could you give me just a little update as what their concerns are?
Say that again.
Nutter Ranch.
I can give you a copy of the letter when we're done.
That would be great.
Essentially what these landowners are saying is if we open it up to any bull, trespass is going to be an issue. And it has been any bull in the past, and they dealt with those problems year after year. Another part of it is that even though only 15 to 20% of the land is private land in this unit, 80-85% of the elk are on that land. And so the fear is if it goes any bull, guys are going to go out there, not see anything, and be very, very tempted to go on private land to get one. That's the gist of the argument there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But Justin, just so I clarify this, other than Nutter Ranch, I can't remember who all signed that letter, they're already surrounded by any bull.
Correct.
And in the area that you're considering changing to any bull, what is your level of support there from landowners?
Okay, so
we know Nutter Ranch is opposed.
Sure. And
what are the other landowners?
The other landowner that we've talked to there, Butch Jansen, he's in favor of keeping it any bull. And at the rack, he and several people that work on his ranch were heavily in favor of any bull on that.
And that's the Tavaputz Ranch, right?
Correct. Yeah. And that's the extent of the land.
Any other landowners that?
Not south of that dry creek, dry canyon. So.
Move on then.
Sure.
Thank you, Anise.
You bet.
Next item is this general season open bull north of the highway.
Yeah, that's another issue that was on the action log and another one that's in Justin's area. So basically this was bore out of a landowner in that area that wanted that to become any bull. It's currently part of the San Juan Limited Entry Unit. And again, Justin had a committee formed in that area where former board member Keel Johnson attended that meeting. And they really were fairly split down the middle, whether it should go one way or the other. And since then, the one landowner that was complaining has become part of a CWMU in that area, so it really has become a non-issue. So basically, we recommend doing nothing and leaving it as a limited entry unit.
Good way to solve it. Any questions, members of the board? No, we'll leave it there then. Thank you. Next item is antler restrictions. Denise?
So that one, again, an action log item. In the action log, it said that we would look at recommending two units in the state where we would try antler point restrictions, one in the north part of the state and one in the south part of the state. We went back and looked at all of our information, and to be honest, as a division, we do not feel comfortable recommending any antler restrictions on any units because of the biological things that go along with that, not to mention the law enforcement issues that go along with that. So we do not intend to recommend antler point restriction 3-point or better or 4-point or better anytime soon.
I don't think there's enough changes going on as it is, Anise. I don't know why you wouldn't want to throw that on there.
Yeah, that's another good reason.
I mean, I think there, all seriousness, I think there's plenty of changes. We're taking huge steps to try to improve things. I think that could be something we could look at down the road again if we decide to. But now I don't know that it fits into.
It really does. And biologically, it's just an unsound way to manage mule deer. It just is. Not any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Questions? You're rolling right along, Anise. Next item. We got Greg here.
Greg's on his way. If you wanted to take a 5-minute break, this would probably be a good time.
Okay, we can do that.
Apples. Take a bite of the apple.
That's a lot of sharp tails.
You don't want to get too tied down to it, do you?
I told you that the last time we were
at the He's Greg's here. What's the deal?
It's not nice to show up. See
what's the occasion, man?
That Wyoming?
Yeah, it'd be easier.
Cool. Ta-da. Cool.
What's that?
I'll ask that right now. I have a question.
Greg just finished it 3 minutes ago.
Why are we getting papers instead of in electronic format?
Because I have yet to receive it in electronic format, so let's direct that to the coordinator.
What's wrong with the timber industry and paper? I think. You know.
It's almost 2012. You need to evolve a little bit, Greg.
I know. They said they put email on my computer or something like that.
They said they put email on your computer, on your Commodore 64 as email.
You're going to have to do it off that screen. That's fine. Jimmy, just a minute. This thing takes forever with the PGP trap.
What's PGP?
This encryption software that they put on.
Through the internet, get it through a laptop there, maybe.
Or there's wireless.
We get into our internet there.
Yeah, or there's wireless in this room. What do you need?
They want to look at the map.
The Range Creek map on the. It won't be exactly like that, I don't think.
It'll look a little
maybe
different.
Maybe it will. Maybe that is the map.
Yeah, we can get access to that map.
Update your computer. Find PowerPoint.
Are they ready?
We need to put in the software. Sorry.
That finger she points. Look at that thing. I've got a blade that shoots at the end of it.
Go tell me which one it is over there.
It's called Surrenders and Variants. Right. I think it's the bottom one.
I got it.
That's fine.
My good heck.
The whole world would agree with me.
Recording. I don't think we're going
to. Did it unboot?
Hey, do this.
We just shut down.
That is the longest finger I've ever seen in my life.
Can I pull this out? Is it going to be okay?
That should be a ray. One. It should be a registered weapon.
No, we'll just put it back.
Where you wield that thing around.
That's fine. We'll just go with that one. They're getting antsy. I'm just going to yank this. Okay, let's just. It's not looking so good.
Yeah, I'm
getting nervous now. On the carpet shock and these things.
That's real long.
Is that unplugged in?
Thanks. Thank you.
I'm amazed you're able
okay.
to eat that much apple. Watermelon.
Yeah, it is.
Apologize for the delay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and board members. We've got an action item that we'd like to address today rather than tomorrow, just so we don't drag things out too long tomorrow. This item's been on the agenda action item log for a couple of years at various times now. We're hoping to kind of wrap it up today. It came up earlier this spring in May, and then we decided to defer it till sometime this fall for a variety of reasons. The item itself deals with surrenders. That's what's on the action log. But we wanted to talk about another area called variances here. Some of you have been on the board for a while, are familiar with variances and some of the things we deal with on that. Others newer have had a quick induction as you've come to some of these last couple board meetings and had people come to you and present situations that have occurred to them during their hunts or prior to their hunts or whatever, and ask for extensions or various different things. Those are variances. So we want to train you a little bit on that a little bit today and talk about what that rule provides for, and then show you some data of the impact of some of these variances since we changed some rules a few years back. So if it's okay with you, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go through quickly the surrenders and variances, the full thing, and then kind of rewind and talk about it. And the reason I do that is sometimes there's sort of a gray line between where surrenders and variances begin and then moving back and forth. So I want you to sort of see the whole picture, and then we'll go ahead and discuss these if that works for you. Surrenders of permits, as I mentioned, this is the item that was asked for as a board action item. And essentially, there was a desire to find out if there was an abuse of the system in the surrender process. Back in 2008, this item was addressed by the board. And at that time, we had a large discussion about people who had put in groups because they had a lot of bonus points, and then they'd be successful in drawing a permit, and then they'd surrender their permit and get all their points back, and everybody who was in that group was a beneficiary of that person who had the high points, and then this individual could go back in again next year because they still had all their points. So at that time, the board made a rule change and said, if you're in a group and you surrender, then everybody's got to surrender so that we're not sharing points perpetually, if you will. So that was one thing that was addressed back then. Another thing
to
that came up.
To add to that, though, Greg, there were guys that were selling this, their participation in a group on eBay.
Yeah, and, we had a little bit of that.
I've got 15 bonus points put in with me, and you'll get the hunt of your dreams. And then the guy with 15 bonus points would turn in his tag and do it again next year.
We had some entrepreneurial individuals, but I don't think a lot, but it existed a little bit, yeah. So that was something that we didn't want to have happen. I think we were able to curb some of that on the group area. In 2010, the legislature made some changes providing for the board to have a greater latitude in refunds. And after that legislation was passed and some fees passed, $25 handling fee, the board made a rule that said if you surrender more than 30 days before one of these hunts begins, a limited entry or once-in-a-lifetime hunt begins, you can have your money back, less a handling fee. And part of the intent there was to pull people who may be scouting for some of their trophy hunts and say, oh, I'm not seeing much. I think I'll just turn it in a day before the hunt and get all my points back, and I'll try again next year. So by providing for these refunds more than 30 days before hunt, kind of gave them a carrot, said, well, if you're going to turn it in, fine, but you don't have to eat all that money that you would lose by turning it in the day before the hunt. And by us having 30 days, it kind of gave us some more room internally to reallocate these permits, because when we get these permits back, we try to sell them to the next person on the list. So those are a couple of things that have happened to try to address that. But there's still some issues worth talking about out there. We talked about the scouting issue just a moment ago. And what I think the board is largely interested in today is, because we allow these surrenders at the last moment or near the last moment, are we hurting other people, even though we can reissue those and sell those to somebody else? Are we giving them a maximum opportunity to go hunt? Are we giving them the quality hunt they want? All of us enjoy finding out in late spring that we've drawn one of these trophy permit opportunities. But if you find out 3 days before that hunt begins that you've got the permit, is that really the same experience? You don't maybe have time to scout. You don't have all of the excitement that, you know, you going and looking at new binoculars and all the things that us hunter people do when we know we're going to go on a big hunt. So there's still a little bit of that, and so that's kind of what we're looking at today. So we've got a little bit of data, and hopefully we can answer some of these questions. Here's a couple years' worth of surrendered data that we have, and this is only once in a lifetime and limited entry permits. We do have some surrenders on general season stuff, but right at the moment here, we're not really discussing that. In 2010, we had about 9,000 limited entry type permits. We had about 413 surrender. We were able to overall reallocate about 47% of those. But if you look at the time frame in the yellow column there, people who surrender more than 30 days out, we were able to reallocate to other hunters 80% of those. People who were less than 30 days out, only about 27%. Now, the penalty, as we mentioned earlier, is if you do it within 30 days, you don't get your money back. You get your points back, but you don't get your money back. So they kind of have to eat the cost of those. But some individuals are willing to do that. In 2011, our reallocation rate this year was a little bit higher. We were up to 67%. And within or more than 90 days, we reallocated 92% of the permits. Less than 30 days, 38%. So we did better, but we still had some permits that we weren't able to get back out to our hunters. Yeah, Jake.
Do you think that's because people don't know about the rule?
People meaning the
hunters who had the permits?
The rule meaning if they'd come 30 days sooner?
Right.
I'm sure there's some people who don't know about the rule, you know, there's a variety of reasons. And when we allow people to surrender permits, we ask them, what's the reason you surrendered it? And there's a variety of reasons. Some of them are injured, ill, can't get off work, daughter's wedding, couldn't find an animal that I liked on the, you know, there's a variety of things. So we try to get that, but.
When are they issued the permit? When do they know in the draw process?
Well, on the big game, it's normally May, but in this, we've got, you know, turkey and cougar and bear, so there's different times of year depending on the hunt, but most of these hunts, there's a pretty good advance warning.
A pretty good window that they know what's
only one might be exceptions, the cougar. You know, that's a pretty tight window from mm-hmm. when we have the draw to when the hunts begin.
But the majority of these surrenders are bull elk?
Yeah, about 45% of the ones we surrender are limited entry bull elk, and that's the it's probably the biggest single one we have. We have got about 3,000 limited entry bull elk permits. So, but they're a little bit disproportionately high, and that, you know, could be a variety of reasons. But again, there are some people who've gone out in the field and scout around a little bit. The question is, you know, is that enough to maybe potentially change rules that penalize a lot of people? You know, do we just throw a net out to catch a few guys that we don't like the fact that they scout and say, no, I'm not seeing the antlers I want this year. I'll try again next year because I got 18 points and I know I can get it next year. You know, so we kind of walk this fine line of, there are things we can do to cramp down, but then we pay the price. On this group thing I mentioned, we had some people who were abusing our group process, no doubt about it. But then what we've run into is some legitimate people who want to surrender, who draw a permit in a group, and maybe they can't go. And then they got to call their friends and say, I can't do this. So I want to surrender it. So I have this opportunity next year. Will you guys, the rest of you in my group, will you all surrender so that I can surrender? And they're like, I don't care if you got that problem. I'm going hunting next week, kind of a deal. So there's two sides of that. So we got the eBay guys and the KSL guys selling their points, but now we've hurt some legitimate groups who just want to surrender a permit and can't do it because of the rule we put in place. So we always have to be careful when we look at kind of motives and why people are doing some of these different things. So now we have lots of complaints, I'd say, Judy, every year of these group people coming in going, you got to be kidding. I can't give you my elk tag back unless I get the, you know, other person or three other people who do it with me to give theirs back as well. So that's why we need to move carefully as we go to that. By the way, I've got Judy here who deals with a lot of these. Judy Tetero, who's our licensing coordinator, and so she's going to straighten me out if I get some of this wrong today. But she does a great job with these items every year, and her staff. One thing after looking at this past slide that comes to mind is, well, why don't we tell everybody you got to do it more than 30 days? We're able to reallocate, you know, over 90% of the permits. We're going to give a better quality hunt to people. Why don't we just make that be the new rule? So we looked at kind of some of the pros and cons of doing, of making every, all surrenders happen more than 30 days from the start of the hunt. Some of the pros, we would be able to reallocate more permits. People could plan and have better opportunity for those reallocated hunters. It reduces some of the scouting and surrenders by the high point holders, and it forces more permits to qualify for refunds. That doesn't help our money situation, but if you're a person surrendering, it gets you more money back. Some of the cons, it impacts adverse lifetime impact events. People can't get off work. They got weddings, you know, different things that could pop up in life that now they can't surrender this, in a close time frame. Potentially a continued increase in variance applications, and we'll talk about variances in a minute. Some people might say, well, if I can't give it back, then I'm injured all of a sudden. My back's sore, my ankle's sore. I got a doctor's note. I want to hunt next year. And so are we going to push people into that, you know, maybe not being as accurate as they could be. This wouldn't be consistent with other states, and we'll talk about other states in a moment. Lost revenue from being able to reallocate permits. So right now, within the 30-day window, we sell these permits twice. We get double the money, if we can reallocate them. A lot of them we don't reallocate, as you saw, but the ones we reallocate, we get the revenue twice. And this may increase wildlife board appeals. You may have more people come in and want to ask for variances or other considerations. So we don't want to push more things to the board if we can. Apologize for this next slide. We're kind of I developed this PowerPoint, a little bit newer version of software than we're using now, so it made it all skiwampus. But other states. Okay, do they have a surrender policy in other states? And so in Utah, yeah, we have it 30 days or more, and you get your refunded points. Within 30 days, points only. Idaho, yes, they'll take surrenders, and they have a sliding scale. So by July 1st, you get back 3/4 of your money. By August 1st, you get half your money. September 1st, 1/4 of your money. After that, you don't get any money. So that's how they do that in Idaho. Arizona. They don't have surrenders, but you can transfer a permit to a minor child or grandchild or do a 501c3. So that's one thing they do if you can't use your permit. Nevada, yes, you can surrender, but you only get your points back. And then once in a lifetime, they can do it by July 15th, and the others are one day prior to the season without getting your money back. New Mexico, yes, you can surrender, but only for military injury or death. And prior to the hunt, Wyoming, the same. Colorado, yes, before the season begins. But you only get your refund or your points, but not both back. So that gives you kind of a sampling, Jake.
I hate to interrupt again.
No, you're fine.
Have we ever looked at like a yes on the Arizona one, but also you could transfer it to a child or a 501?
We've talked about that. I don't remember how many years ago we brought a long time ago. I think I had the board brought the board a whole list of options for changing all these things. One thing we talked about was, you know, maybe transferring to other individuals. We looked at how to do draw points differently and things. And it hasn't been a recent conversation, to be honest with you, but it does exist in a couple of states out there. So.
I thought I had an email on my phone here from another gentleman that had requested that, but I don't. I think I probably deleted it off there, but I think I sent a copy of it into the division a year ago.
Yeah, that item is one that when we talked about it, that's not something that the board could do without a code change. And certainly we can do a code change. We did one a couple of years ago for refunds, but right now the code says that licenses may not or permits may not be transferred to another individual. So if that's a direction we wanted to go, that would certainly be something we'd have to start with the legislature and then. Adopt whatever they came up with on that. But it doesn't mean you can't do it. It's just we've not done it. So, but it's a good discussion item. Okay, so what do we want to do about all of this? If any changes were desired, we need to bring a rule change to the RACs and board. And we certainly are. This is a work item today. There's not a proposal here. This is kind of a discussion item. I know we've got this looking sort of formally set up here, but we can talk about ideas you have or concerns or other questions you have. The data itself doesn't indicate a significant level of abuse. We think we can increase the number of reallocated permits without changing any rules by doing a few things internally. One is make only one call to alternate. So if somebody surrenders a permit, sometimes we'll spend a couple days trying to hunt this person down, the next guy on the list, to see if they want it. And then after a couple days, they're like, well, give me a day to think about it. And, you know, and the clock's ticking here, especially if you get these permits a week before the hunt. So what we're saying is, you know, we're going to call you once. You got 24 hours to decide. Then we move on to the next person. So we kind of tighten up our customer friendliness of trying to get everybody that permit in their hands. Our regions, they sometimes takes a few days to get that back to us from our regions after they get over surrender. We could expedite that and therefore get allocating those a little quicker. This was kind of an interesting one here. We could reallocate non-resident permits. Right now, if a non-resident surrenders, we go after non-residents only to fill it. Now, that's fine if they surrendered in July. But if they do it a week before the hunt, it's pretty hard to call people and say, you know, somebody who's a non-resident, say, hey, do you want this elk permit? Starts 3 days from now. And the guy's in Florida or Pennsylvania or wherever. So we could say within more than 30 days, we'll keep going with non-residents. Less than 30 days, we'll just go to residents only. So that's a possibility. And there's other internal processes that we could do to expedite some of that. There's one more bullet point. Oh, anyway, if we made some of these changes, these wouldn't even really require a rule change. It may on the residents to non-residents. We'd have to ask Marty that. I think he's here somewhere. But I think we could get those reallocation rates even better than we've got them now. We've certainly made some progress. But that's why we're discussing this today and why the board asked us to bring it up. So, something we could definitely talk about. So would you like to move on then and talk about variances and then go back to this, or do you want to stop here, Mr. Chairman?
Presentation and we can come back.
Let's do that, and then we'll go back, because this might give you some different ideas, too, as we talk about variances. Okay, history of variances at DWR. Years ago, any variance request we had came to the board. We didn't have a rule in place that talked about how we dealt with these things. If a hunter with a permit came in, or almost any situation that deviated off of our rule, we would put a person potentially on a board agenda and come here and they could have a discussion with you. You've seen some of those in the last couple board meetings, and you've got more coming up. In 2008, after some discussion with the board, it was apparent that there was a desire to some of these things that came in, and an individual would come in and say, look, headed out on my horse the first day of the hunt, didn't get to hunt, broke my leg, whatever, or before the hunt, can I have my hunt extended? And the board was approving most of those things. They said, can't the division come up with a rule that you guys can address those and leave all these strange situations to us? So we did develop a rule to do that. And the rule allows the division, we created what's called a variance committee, a division variance committee, and we kind of do what the board used to do in these situations. We look at the situations, we look at their notes and letters from their doctors, as long as they provide to the division within 200 days after the closure of a hunt, all this paperwork we need, doctors, letters, or whatever, depending on the situation, we can approve those. If they don't fit into that criteria, we'll pass them forward to the board. And again, you'll have some tomorrow, right? You got two tomorrow. I think you've had some at all of your last few board meetings. But we do a lot more of those in the division now, and we'll show you a graph here in a second. So here's what's happened. It surprised us a little bit, and that's why we talked about it today, and I think Director Karpowitz wanted us to make you aware of this and see if we need to revisit the rule. Again, we're not here to discuss or to take action on a rule today. But prior to the rule, and you could see data from 2005, 6, and 7, all of those were being addressed by the board. You had 21 of these in 5, 26 of them in 6, and 12 of them in 2007. That's about when we came up with this rule and said, you know, can't you take some of these off of our platter? We wrote a rule that gave provisions and more guidance, and you've got kind of a summary copy up at your table there that you can take with you if you want. But it probably opened the door a little bit more or simplified it a little bit more for individuals to come in and get these variances. So we started escalating to 37 and 8, then 53, then 75. Our year-to-date, we've got 139 of those variances that we've dealt with. And because you can have up to 200 days, some of our hunts aren't even over yet. Some of our hunts haven't even started yet. So it'll be more than 139 by the time this year wraps up. I don't know how many more we'll add, maybe another 10 or 20. Maybe none, I don't know. You can see limited entry elk is the most popular thing that people have been asking for variances on. Now, the items that this rule provides variances for is if you're injured or if someone in your family is injured or dies or has an illness. Anyway, some type of a thing that precludes you from being able to participate. So if you're, I think I said just injured or ill, if someone in your family is injured or ill or passes away, if you're military, those are all things that we can give in a variance and say, here, we'll give you a letter, use your permit next fall. Now that we kind of see this growth in this, we wonder if we need to maybe head this off a little bit so we're not pushing piles of permits into our next hunting year. These numbers don't reduce the next year's hunting cap. So if a limited entry elk unit has 30 bull permits on it next year and two variances occur, there'd be 32 permits next year. They don't subtract that off of the next year's number. It's an additive. Some things aren't big, you know, as much of a resource impact. You see 40 general season. That could be deer, elk, or whatever, general season. That's probably not a big resource issue. But if you get into once in a lifetime or some of these other, and we start stacking permits onto the next year, it could potentially be a resource issue. Okay, so looking at the variances that the board used to do, this is the same numbers from the last graph, but they're broke down a little bit differently. You can see the ones that the board's addressing is still the red. You had 15 and 8, 2 of them in 09, 13 and 10, and 16 this year. You haven't had all of them yet. Judy still has a little surprise stack of them that you'll get over the next couple months. But about 16. But our error, our variance committee, we've done about 123 so far this year. So it might be time to relook at the rule. Reasons for variance, I described to you what they were. Here's kind of a distribution of how those occur every year. About 60% of them were illness or injury to oneself. 32% to an immediate family illness or injury, I should put, or potentially death. Military is only about 3% and others 5%. So those are kind of the categories. You can see how that breaks out. So what do other states do on this matter? Again, sorry about this slide. In Utah, yes, we have a variance policy for injury, illness, family, or military. It allows for extensions. Okay, Idaho, yes, for military only when there's deployed. So they just do military, and then they'll give you a rain check or a permit, if you will, for the following year. Arizona, the only thing you can do there is transfer it to a minor child. Nevada has no variance program. New Mexico has one for military only, and that can be transferred to a friend or family. Wyoming, yes, but only for moose or bighorn sheep for illness and military. So they've just got a couple of species, and Colorado has no provision. So certainly Utah is the most variance-friendly of all of them put together, probably. as far as allowing for this type of activity. So possible changes. One, we could end variances altogether. I don't know if that'd be a likely resolution, because I think our attorney Marty Bushman would come up and tell you that people can still appeal to the board. But anyway, that's a possibility. We could end variances on general season and antlerless only. Okay, so leave some of the limited entry stuff and once in a lifetime on there, but take these general deer and elk out, so you can't get an extension in the next year. We could end all variances except for military. That's what a few of the other states have done that we just looked at. We could still allow for permits to be surrendered after the end of the hunts using the same criteria, but only allow for a refund of points back. We maybe wouldn't let them hunt into the following year, and maybe change the days from 200 down to 60, so we get people a little bit more aggressively contacting us. We could still allow for conservation permit variances. We get some of those, and, you know, the question is, you know, we try to treat everyone the same, but some of these individuals will pay $100,000, $200,000, $250,000 for these, and they may have a situation where you may want to say, well, maybe for that one permit, you know, we could allow that to extend. We could make permit holders whole by eliminating variances and providing refunds for up to 60 days. We could allow only one variance extension for a subject permit. And we haven't had a lot of multiple extensions, but one or two. And we could tighten up the definition of injury or illness. Right now, most of these people have very legitimate things. They'll send us x-ray pictures of, you know, car wrecks and legs all, you know, pinned back together. And there's very serious things. But occasionally we get a few people, a small percent, that probably aren't really all that bad off, who just want to extend their permit to next year. And that's part of the reason why we wanted to have this discussion is, you know, it kind of gets into that, do we surrender it, you know, before the hunt in our first part of our discussion, or do we try to get a variance and say, well, I've got some conditions that maybe I just want to have my hunt next year. I don't want to surrender it and try to draw it again. I just want you to let me have it again next year without really doing anything. And certainly I could tell you, over the years, we've really seen the coveted nature of this. Once these people draw these permits, I think our public's come to an expectation that, A, I was entitled to get this permit. B, I'm owed, you know, a trophy opportunity hunt. And C, it better be a trophy quality animal I harvest. And if any of those don't happen, I'm not happy with the Division of Wildlife, because I finally drew my elk, and I deserve a 390 bull out, because that's just how this works, you know. So things come up. Fires come up on some of our units. Other weather conditions come up, you know, personal family things. And people don't want to hand those permits back. They want to get their elk. And this board, and especially for some of the board members have been here a few years, have had to contend many times with individuals come in saying why they didn't get a quality hunt, and they want something else to give them an extension. And so those things certainly occur. So that's a lot. I know I've been rambling through this, but hopefully you got some ideas or thoughts you want to talk about. I can go back to surrenders if you'd like and start there. We'll take lots of notes.
Any questions?
I was just going to ask, what was the original rationale behind the 200-day period? That seems like a lot.
I think Marty came up. We sat around a room and came up with more than the end
Marty,
of the season.
Alan.
It, 200 is not very scientific. It's past the end of the season, but a long time before the next one starts. It could have been 150 or 132 or whatever. It's 200. So certainly that's a changeable number of days. Yeah.
Like that gives you a long time to think up an excuse to
potentially. Yeah.
Go
although
graph,
most of our people, what's that? The graph? On the variances?
Maybe an answer to that, if you want to know. I think my recollection is it relates to when the next application period. Thinking about when are people going to know for sure what their status is, because some people didn't know what their status was. And so does that sound familiar, Marty? Isn't that what we looked at is when did it tie?
Yeah, vaguely. All of these people cannot have participated in the hunt, so waiting that long doesn't change things much. I mean, it just gives them
We have a nice warm seat for you, Marty.
You know, go ahead, Marty.
Bring me all the way up here and then come
off. We're not going to talk into why 200 is a perfect day, so we can all talk for a while.
I don't know. There was nothing legal about the 200 days, that's for certain. And I vaguely remember looking at application periods, and we discussed about what would be appropriate. We wanted to give enough time that would give everybody an opportunity but not make it too long and certainly not carry it into the next year. They still have to meet the factor they cannot have participated in the hunt, or at least for the division, can't participate at all for them to grant the variance. The Wildlife Board, they, you know, you've got some discretion if they've had some minimal amount of participation in the hunt. So we just looked at it and thought the 200 days doesn't really change much. I mean, they either hunted or they didn't. And those people are all the same, whether they've got 60 days to file or 200 days.
I just wanted to point out on both of these, both the reallocations and the variances, we are far more customer friendly than any other Western state. In fact, to the point where it's becoming really difficult for us and the board, especially with variances. Now, if we're just going to talk about reallocations here for a minute, are we?
It's a work meeting, so
you're the director,
we might
man.
Be bouncing back and forth a bit, but
I just want to point at this graph again. This is a program out of control. It's in an exponential growth phase. The next dot on that graph is up above your screen 4 inches. And we've got to make some changes, or it's going to get out of hand for the division and the board. You can see if we took general season and antlerless and other out of there, it cuts it almost in half. So that would be a logical first step, and we can do that and see what happens. But I think also the board, the word's kind of out. If you go to the board, you'll get your season extension. And we're not scrutinizing them quite at the level we used to. I know that, for example, Paul Niemeyer, he really was careful. If a guy had the opportunity to hunt, they didn't get a season extension. Now people are getting season extensions that have had the opportunity to hunt. So we're kind of, our standards are relaxing over time, and the word's getting out, and now these variances are getting pretty high in number, and they're very time consuming. We spent hours on some of these grueling, trying to decide whether we can grant the variance or not, or whether it goes to the board. And we got to reel this in. We're way more friendly in this regard than any other state. Other states don't have quite the sympathy for people that we do. But it is getting very difficult to administer. So I think some changes in both the reallocation process and the variances need to happen quick. So just my opinion. I'm also worried about the board's time. I've watched it, the board's time in dealing with variances. It looked just like this graph. We're into two-day board meetings now because we spend a good chunk of every board meeting dealing with variances. And that will get out of control, and the board will, I mean, what's next, a three-day board meeting for more variances? We've got to tighten this up. Even at the expense of some people that are unhappy because they didn't get two opportunities to go hunting.
I got a question for you, Greg, on the 200 days. 200 days is, that seems like a long time to me. But couldn't you put a date on there? All this stuff has to be done by...
Well, you got
first of January.
Turkey and cougar and bear and lots of different hunts. You know, you got archery hunts that start in August. You got cow elk hunts that will be running into January. But although we have 200 days on there, and talking with Judy a little bit, the vast majority of these people are making contact with us before the hunt begins or during the hunt or within a week or two after it. I'm not sure shaving it from 200 even to 100 would change our numbers much. These people aren't waking up one day in March going, gee, that elk hunt I was going to do last fall was a bust. I got 3 days left to go talk to the division. They're, you know, if you got this tag and you want this, these people are pretty prompt in getting hold of us and saying, hey, what's my options? You know, I broke my leg. I want to hunt next year. And is that pretty accurate, Judy, would
you
say?
Yeah, it is. And the problem with the 200-day issue, too, is if it exceeds that, we have to come to the board and you guys have to deal with those. In fact, you'll have one in January now. And so if we've set that at a 60-day and it's past that, then we can no longer deal with it unless we change the rule and give ourselves that authority. It would have to come to you guys just because we've exceeded that point. So that's one thing to keep in mind.
Two board meetings ago, one came to us that was about 260 days. And we said, no, you're up past 200. And it came to you at 260, and it got approved here. So I don't know, you know, how we kind of draw the line on that. So.
So do you want 400 days, or do you want to cut it to 30 days? What's the way to go here?
Well, I think the big conversation is, what do we want to be doing here? And that, you know, we tried in 2008, we wrote a rule. Do you like it? You got 4 years of data. Is this where we wanted to be? Are we doing what we needed to, or do we need to do what Jim said and revisit it now? You know, it's always easy to speculate when you create a new rule what you're going to build for yourself. If we like it, we can change it from 200 to 100, but is it still the – I don't think it would change these numbers much at all. Maybe a few.
Marty was going to say something legal, I think.
You're making an assumption. But it is legal. So the board knows is there's been some discussion that if we change the 200-day time limit, which is a limit that's on the division's authority, or the number of, you know, how much hunting can occur or none at all, that's also a limit on the division's authority, that it will just defer everybody to the Wildlife Board. And what we'll have is the same number of variance requests, only the board will be fielding a greater number. Now, the board in this rule has given itself authority to grant these variances. You can also take that authority away and limit the board's authority. It's pretty wide open right now. You can grant it for just about anything. There's very few restrictions, but we could rewrite the rule and tighten it up so that we tighten it up both at the division's level and the board level, so hopefully we don't see more variance requests coming to the board as opposed to the division.
How many people, when they come wanting a extension or wanting their hunt, wanting to be able to hunt again next year, have actually had, and maybe there's no answer to this, we don't know, have actually had a chance to spend some time on their hunt, a day or two, or
well,
do we know?
The ones that the board, that the division can do, these blue ones, none have. If they've had time in the field, our variance committee has to defer them to you.
To the board.
So if you look at the red ones that you've got down there, and I'm only going to guess, and I'll have Judy guess because she presents most of these, but I'm saying maybe two or three a year are people who've been out in the field and had it. You got one tomorrow. A few a year have been out in the field and for some reason weren't able to, you know, harvest. They were injured during, you know, early on, or maybe they saw a few animals but not really that trophy one, and they want that opportunity. Fires has been one. You know, I got out there and hunted, and there were fires, and they had all the roads blocked. I hunted, could never find anything. You know, I was out there for 5 days, could never find a place to hunt. We've had several of those over the years.
So the vast majority of these are about illness, illness of the hunter or even a family member.
Correct. Illness or injury. Yeah.
And we deal with nearly all of those, and the board does not. Right?
Right.
The illness and injury, you shouldn't have to deal with any unless they've had opportunity in the field. Would be
so
the
really
one
the problem is that the division has accepted almost any illness or injury excuse for a variance.
I think we had a sprained ankle yesterday. You had a sprained ankle. I sprained my ankle. I couldn't go hunting. Got a doctor's note, said my ankle was sprained. I want my hunt next year. We didn't define when this rule was created what an injury is. Do you have to, you know, have multiple broken bones? You could have bronchitis. And if your doctor says you shouldn't be hunting tomorrow, you automatically, if you bring in that note, you'll get your hunt next year.
So we didn't define, and I don't know that you can ever define how injured, you know, what's that definition of how badly you're injured, but I could tell you. But in fairness, 90% of these people are very injured, okay? There's something pretty wrong with them, and there's probably 10% where we'd like to have a little more latitude in that and say, come on, you know.
Greg, these are approved variance requests. What about the numbers that come in that don't get approved? How does that stack on top of that?
The blue ones, Judy knows the rule pretty well on what we can approve here. So not many would ever come to our variance committee that we wouldn't approve, because she'll tell them, you don't meet the criteria. So most of the blue ones, if they come to us, they're pretty much approved. The red ones are kind of hit and miss what happens. Now, we did show the 16 for 2011. That's how many you're going to address that we know about so far this year. You probably won't approve quite all of those. We don't know how the year is going to work out. But
I guess my question is, how many are coming in that aren't being approved that you're telling that you're not going to make it? What's the number of those per year?
Most of all the ones that come in are approved. They meet the criteria. Like Greg said, if they don't, they become a board issue because they've hunted. So
you're not weeding out a bunch off the top?
Absolutely not.
So in order to make a significant difference in this graph we're looking at, one thing you can do is narrow the types of permits that qualify, which would reduce it by 40 to 50%. And the other thing would be to tighten up the illness or injury criteria. And they would have to be a more significant type of injury or illness than what we've been granting in the past. Is that right?
Those are a couple of options.
If you're really going to make any dent in this graph at all, that's about your only two options, isn't it?
Yeah, and one concern that's come up is, it isn't that hard to go to your doctor and get a note. And I don't think we have widespread abuse, so don't get me wrong on that. But when we go to 30 units here pretty quick, and soon there will be some coveted units in the 30, you'll have more of these general season kind of people potentially coming back really wanting to hunt that unit 18 next year or whatever it may be.
Jim, so, on the injury and illness part of the rule, Greg's right, it does not define the types of injuries or illness that qualify, but the rule does say that it has to completely preclude them from participating in the activity. And that's a pretty stringent requirement, but the problem we run into is doctors are very willing to sign that statement, you know, to say they're completely precluded. And that's where it gets really difficult when we have to start matching the judgment of a biologist or a lawyer against that of a doctor and saying whose opinion should carry the greater weight. I don't know how you solve that one exactly.
Well, has something like a sprained ankle been accepted in the past as a reason not to hunt or
not
can't
since
hunt?
Yesterday.
Well, it's because the doctor said that he was precluded and could not hunt. He was on crutches. It was a severely sprained ankle, and they're worse than breaks, and that's what the doctor concluded to. So, it sounds kind of like it shouldn't hurt that bad, but...
Kevin,
I guess the big question, should we even be doing it for illness or injury? Most states don't.
Take it out. You know, if you're active military and you're out, great, we'll give it to you. If you die, now maybe we will, maybe we won't. Maybe if your parents die or somebody else. You know, take the illness or injury completely out. Good grief, guys. Life happens. Stuff happens. Deal with it.
I'd like to think that if there was a death in the immediate family, somebody would be.
Yeah, we'd probably give them that.
Or a situation like that, but getting sick or something. I mean, especially where, in the current rules, if I sprain my ankle today and my hunt starts tomorrow, I can turn my tag in and draw again next year. I don't.
Maybe.
No, you'd go.
I'm not planning on changing that rule just in case that happens for you, Greg.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I think we need to tighten it up. It seems like the director said, we get a little more lax every time, especially if somebody's had time to go in the field. I mean, you know, you might pass up a decent animal the first day hoping to get a big one the next, and then something happens. Well, you had a chance. I don't know that we need to be approving all those.
Go ahead, Kevin.
I think there's one other option, and I'm
a member of the variance committee, and it's something that we talk about on there quite a bit, is, and Greg had it up there, if instead of extending permits, if we just make people whole, we give them their points back, so then they're back in, they're taking their chance again. That takes some of that incentive away. Because the precedent that has been established is that you're going to get your season extended to the next year. If we change that to no, you're not going to get your season, but we'll give you your points back and you can take your chance in the draw again, that's a lesser incentive to go through the process.
You could not only do what Kevin suggests, give your points back, you could even, it's your latitude, you could even give them a refund if you want. Say if all this happens to you, you know, we'll give you all but your $10 for your points
whatever. You know, and when that's happening, that takes out the concern of the biologic, that you know, the impacts of how this graph goes, because now you're not stacking additional people onto next year's hunt, because it's still going to be the same. They're going to have to go back into the draw. So you're not adding new people on there the next year, in approving any of these requests. So
I'm getting a little uncomfortable. We're sitting here with the seven of us who are not very knowledgeable on the topic and haven't been through one micro bit of what Judy's been through and the variance committee. And I don't think I'm very competent in giving solid direction on what direction you ought to go to. I think we've all said we'd like to see things tightened up a little bit, and we can see that it's out of control and spiraling. But I'd feel much more comfortable, rather than trying to make a snap decision in a one-hour discussion, of asking maybe you come back to us with your proposals on what you think ought to be done with the variances.
Well, that's the plan.
Yeah.
We just wanted the board to be able to weigh in on it before we made a recommendation.
But I will tell you that I'm in favor of doing away with the general season in Annales.
Go ahead, Alan.
The other thing, and we, as we went through this and talked about it, you could merge the surrender and variance thing too. Part of the concept that Kevin said of making people whole, if you can surrender their permit, surrender it. They're not eligible for a variance if they can surrender under our rule. So you push all anybody that could be made whole by the surrender process, you do that, and the variance is left for somebody that can't be. That might be, for instance, a conservation permit holder. It might be somebody that's injured the first day of their hunt. It might be, you know, a few things like that. And that would also narrow it down if you did that in conjunction with Jake suggested eliminating the general season and the antlerless stuff. And I think we could get it back down to a much smaller thing. Because I think, Judy, from our discussion the other day, I believe that people now know they have an option. And somebody's drawn that permit rather than do a surrender, whereas in the past they might have asked for a surrender. Now they're saying, hey, I'd much rather have a variance than have my season extended.
Yeah, they're right? waiting till after the fact.
So they're kind of shopping
yep.
the deal. And if we narrow the narrow where the deal can be made, that also might help address part of that too.
That's what I was trying to get at. Alan did a better job at articulating it.
I would. Just kind of second what Alan's saying. I think if we could use the surrender, you know, I think that should be the first option. And then if that's not, obviously not possible, you know, then a variance would be in order. But, and kind of going along with what Jake said, I see no, to me, it's just ridiculous to look for a variance for a antlerless tag. I think we need to do away with those, my personal opinion, and general season. You're going to draw those again. I've never seen a cow elk that I just couldn't live without shooting until I drew the tag again next year. I think we'll be okay. I think we need to do away with
That's
those.
Spectacular, huh?
Yeah.
You know, certainly one theme we talked about, and it's what both Kevin and Alan have mentioned, you know, you came into this draw, whether you had max points, like you're saying, John, you're guaranteed to draw again next year, get healthy again or whatever is going on in your life and draw it next year, or maybe you only had 4 points and you drew a moose permit. Maybe if we make you whole again, well, you're lucky to get the first place. Be thankful that we acknowledge you had a life event, whatever that may be, and we put you back to 4 points, or now soon to be 5 points. And we made you whole, and that's the consideration that we have. A lot of these states, most of these states we look at don't do anything. You know, it's military is seems to be the standout thing where they're pretty lax. And the other thing that Jake mentioned is, what about handing this permit off to a youth or another group?
I'd like to see you guys look at that a little bit, especially like a general season or a cow tag or something like that, where they could give it to an 18-year-old or younger.
And again, that's a code change.
With
but
a
we
fee,
certainly,
you know.
Yeah, it's certainly something we could move forward with if the board felt strongly about it, because it's not legislation that most of our legislators would ever think about running, and it's not something you can pass here. So I guess if there's direction that we look at that some more, that's something we could talk about with the director and see about something.
What's
like
your
that.
Opinion of that? Are we opening Pandora's box, allowing transfer of permits?
I don't think I'm allowed to have opinion. I work here still. But one thing for certain.
Your professional opinion.
My professional. There's a very kind factor. And certainly we talk about recruiting youth and things, and there'd be some value potentially in getting some kids out there. Honestly, we've had people come to us and say, why don't you run a broader legislation that says, what if I draw this permit after 18 years? I want to have my 17-year-old kid shoot the thing. I'd rather have that happen than me shooting at this point because I'm getting old, you know. So there's different levels, you know. Do you do this for these people who are injured or ill or military? Do you do it for everybody who wants to do that? So, and again, when you run legislation, you don't know what you're going to get. They can do anything they want up on the hill. So, but yeah, a couple other states are doing it. So,
I think I've got a copy of that Arizona bill somewhere in my file at home. I'm sure you got access to it too, but.
Ernie, do we need to formulate some suggestions, or
it's kind of a work? Ernie, I think, is one of the original ones who asked for the surrender discussion. I apologize for kind of piggybacking this variance thing on it, but they go back and forth quite a bit. So make sure we address all the board members' concerns on these topics.
And the variances, I think Judy and the committee have got so darn much experience with what's going on. I'd be very comfortable with them bringing forth the suggestion. And I think everybody agrees that an antlerless permit doesn't deserve the same level of appeal or a general season permit. We've defined that in other areas already. So I'm just comfortable with them working the variance one and coming back.
I guess if we came back, it would likely be, unless you left it as an action log item, it would actually be through a RAC board process with a rule change, and that's when you'd see it next. So we acknowledge that that's probably where we're heading, but if you've got some real strong opinions, any of you, this would be a good time to hear them, because probably what we don't want is to run something out through all the RACs. This is one of these areas we've run into them before. We ran into it on this group thing before where we get out the RACs and everybody has different opinions, and then we get the board and everybody has different opinions, and we kind of end up with this hodgepodge mess thing. So we'd like to have it land kind of close to where we start if possible. So
about a future work session,
I think we're trying to get away from those.
We've pretty much got to get this done before drawing time.
Yeah, if we're going to do
at least
it for next
season,
fall, right? We really need to probably get a rule out to you by sometime mid-spring. These rules have about a month and a half kick-in period before they can start, so probably the latest we could have this to would be, say, a May time frame. You know, I don't know when all the board
we'll
meetings are lined
Stacey,
up. But
yeah. As soon as the drawing is posted, my phone starts ringing about variances. As soon as I find out they've drawn, they've already known that they can't hunt for some reason or another. A lot of them are stricken with cancer, and they know they're not going to hunt. So I think we're going to have to get it out pretty quick to get it approved. And
yeah, that would be our preference, to get moving on it pretty quickly and try to catch you on a board meeting when you weren't dealing with permit numbers and some of the other big deals.
Well, there's
deals
no
we do, so.
Board meeting left between now and permit numbers.
The
yeah, but we, like Judy said, when we passed that surrender rule a couple of years ago, it legally didn't kick in until the middle of the summer, and we had people wanting to surrender, and it was kind of messy. We had people wanting to do surrenders and get their money back, and we're like, well, wait a month till this law takes or this rule takes effect. So,
if we're going to do it, we ought to do it when we do big game permit numbers, right?
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to be a huge deal. I mean, it's if we can merge these two programs and still have a way to make people whole, what we're doing right now is making them more than whole. You not only draw your permit and say you only had two or three bonus points, you're guaranteed a permit the next year. That's more than whole. Whole, in my mind, is no, you can put in for the draw again next year. And so I think if we reel that in and reel in the types of permits and merge the two systems, I think we'll have a good recommendation for the board, okay, and we can get this fixed. But we've gone from being almost too restrictive to too lenient, and we need to find some middle ground.
And what we will try to do is, again, if we say create this rule that tightens it up, right now I think Marty would tell you, if they don't like what we our new rule, they can come back to you and say, we don't like what that committee said or what the rule says. Will you give me an exception to that? And I don't know, you know, how you best move forward from there. Do you want to tighten yourself? We're the front line a little bit, and what we try not to do as best we can is aim people at you. You know, our front counter people could say, you know, sorry, you know, they walk in the front counter, here's the problem. And they say, well, isn't there something I could do? You know, we try not to say, well, you know, if you want to get on the board agenda, they can do anything they want.
But
you know, or you have 500 of these a month because my fishing license expired too soon, or, you know, all kinds of things.
But if the board adopts the same guidelines as the division, there's no incentive to go to the board. The problem's when the board chooses to go a different direction than the division is obligated to do. And then people want a variance. But if the board would buy into staying with the same program as the division, and people would still have to come, but if they would stick with those same guidelines, there would be no incentive to come to the board. You see what I mean?
Oh, Jim? One thing for the board to be prepared for, though, is if we reel in this authority, there will come sympathetic cases that you're going to want to try to do something. And if we write this rule right, you won't be able to. Otherwise, if we leave you that little window of opening, people are going to come flooding through it. And this is kind of the tricky part of it. So it may be it's remedying the relief is, you know, whether it's a season extension. Season extension started a long time ago before the board had any variance authority. We had hunters coming here saying, you know, I broke my leg on the opening day of the hunt. It was a bison hunt, once in a lifetime. And the board wanted to do something, and one thing in code the board has authority over is seasons and setting seasons, and that was an area I felt that they could go ahead and grant an extension. Well, that kind of carried through when we finally wrote the rule as a remedy, but we can pull that out and just have bonus restoration of bonus points. And
you wouldn't – I mean, you'd always want the board to have some variance authority for some really tough cases, but there needs to be some discipline, too, for the – not so tough a cases, but I've seen some cases here that nobody on this planet would have voted against. Kids that are dying.
I'd say most of these, if you heard them, you'd probably go along. And Judy hears them. These are generally pretty bad deals. You know,
they are sad situations, but they don't have to have a season extension. There are other options, and they don't. This doesn't have to apply to every permit we sell. I mean, those are options that we can adopt.
Mr. Chairman, oh, sorry, I was just going to say, I think I would feel very strongly about looking at doing away with the antlerless and the general season variances. I think that would, those don't need to be there. And I would also go on the record as saying, having worked through the rack process for years and years and years, and seeing that if these good folks put together a proposal, by the time they take it through the racks and it comes back here to the board, I think that most any kinks would be worked out, and we would have a real solid idea of what we could do to clean up this process and tighten things up. I think that's one benefit to the rack process, is usually from between the first rack meeting and the last rack meeting, most of the kinks come out in the wash, and you have enough discussion that things get fleshed out pretty good, and I think that they could do a pretty good job. So I'm kind of thinking that if we let them give them our input today and let them take it to the racks, I think by the time we get it back, I think we'll probably be in pretty good shape.
I'd like to jump back to the surrenders for just 1 minute, Greg. The individual surrenders topic focused on individuals that might be chopping their unit after they draw a permit until 3 days before the hunt and then turn it in, get all their points back plus one, and potentially be in great shape to draw that same hunt next year, and they turned it in just because they didn't find the 405-point bull that they wanted. And so somebody else might get the hunt and have 1 day to scout, and he ends up getting screwed. That was kind of the question. How many of those were there? I know you did some research looking for repeat offenders and things like that.
Yeah.
I take it from your recommendation today, then, you concluded that those were so few or something that they were far outweighed by the individuals that might be harmed?
Yeah, what we did is, and it was part of the discussion at last board meeting, we brought this up, is we went back about 5 or 6 years and we said, how many people have drawn a bull elk tag and surrendered it for whatever reason? There aren't preclusions on why you surrender. You can surrender it for any old reason. We ask you, but there's not a yes or no. So how many got it, surrendered? How many got another one? Maybe they're a max point and surrendered again. How many people have done this lots of times? We found about 100 people that have surrendered a permit more than once. About half of those people, and again, we went back 5 or 6 years, I think 6 years, how many of those people have since kept that thing and they're done, so they're out of the system. Maybe they shopped it a couple times and now they're gone. We got maybe 50 people right now that have surrendered a couple of permits and still haven't kept that final permit. Yeah, it's back to, hopefully I explained that well enough, but a few repeat surrenderers, how's that? Not offenders, but surrenderers. You got about 50 people out there that are kind of some level active. And I'm guessing that some part of those, I'll say half, but I don't really know. Let's say half those people have kind of legitimate things in life why they surrendered them. Some of these people have surrendered because they were injured, and I'm not positive that they did know what some of their variance options were, because they, on their reason, they said injured or ill. Maybe we've pushed some of those people into this column that you saw over there, on the variance world that we've talked about as well. But I guess when I mentioned the groups earlier, we can fix those 50 people and say a lot of things, but I hope we're not going to catch a bunch of people who aren't being dishonest or trying to keep scouting and working the whole system, and penalizing a lot of people because of them. Because, yeah, we can write a rule that can end that real fast, you can never draw an elk tag more than twice and surrendered or whatever, but there's a lot of things we could come up with.
In a lot of life, we have rules because a small majority's doing something tricky.
Yeah.
Didn't you say there was a state that had a sliding scale?
Idaho.
Yeah. Idaho. Is that something that you could go back to? I don't know. So many days out, the closer you get to the hunt, the less money you get back and the less points you get. I mean, if it's the day before the hunt, you're not getting your money back or your points, because we can't sell a permit.
Right now, you're getting your points back, but not your money. But yeah, that's an approach that we could
keep
look
half
at.
The points.
We could say,
and then that puts the pressure on them. Well, gee, maybe I do want to hunt this because the likelihood of me getting my points back in my lifetime and getting another permit aren't going to happen.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it.
Yeah, our scale is kind of sliding. It's
everything till 30 days and it's nothing after. We kind of have the cliff approach to our sliding scale.
Maybe you go out 45 days and for every week you get two less points and 20% of your money less.
Yeah.
You know, move it farther out, and the closer they get, the less they get back.
Yeah.
The problem chopping it off.
The problem with that, Calvin, is it still hurts the guy that legitimately, you know, 2 weeks before the hunt or even the day before the hunt, has his horse trailer washed down the canyon because they get in a flash flood in Sago Canyon, like you heard last time. It still hurts that guy that had a, you know, just something completely unforeseen happen that made him so he couldn't hunt.
Ellen.
And again, anybody that's unhappy still can come to you. And, you know, and as long as you guys hold the line, then eventually people realize that you're...
And that's what I see in the graph is all of a sudden we've been a little bit more compassionate and people have taken advantage of that and it's going off the chart. So I agree. Something needs to clamp down and slow things down.
I think some of our people that are... I don't think we have a lot of people abusing this as far as the people we talk about. They go scout and they ride their horse around that mountain all summer long, right up until the day before the hunt. If they can't find a 400 bull, they come in and turn in their permit. Those, and there are a few of those. I've looked at the surrender, you know, the start season start date and the date they surrendered. And there's a few that, not many, but a few who are pretty good at turning that tag in about 2 days before the hunt
maybe
starts.
Maybe get one,
you know?
Surrender.
Yeah, I mean, so there's...
You keep
rules.
Track of it, and you can do it once. If you do it twice, you lose out, and you're done.
Yeah. But, you know, the people that do that are pretty diehard because they don't get a refund. And if they bought their elk tag for $280, they're eating $280 every time they make that call. But, you know, if you waited 18 years and you're guaranteed you're going to draw next year because you got 18 points, maybe it's worth $280 a year or two to scout around the mountainside a little bit. A lot of people enjoy just being out there and seeing those things, you know. So,
okay. Do you have something else, Alan?
I was just going to say, I think I was going to ask Greg, but I think we've heard enough that we could craft a rule, I think, with the input you've given us and let her fly. See what
you
happens.
Guys come with it, and it sounds like the sooner the better, but certainly by May.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Last item on our agenda is Mr. Allen.
I'll do this really quick since we're down this. Just a comment. I think this work session's been really good. We've had probably some of the best discussion we've had as we work through issues. So, you know, I think this kind of worked the way we envisioned these work when we added them. So I think it's been good. Couple things that if you look at the agenda for tomorrow, what I'll do is just review briefly. It's kind of like let you know what's coming. And a lot of you have read the stuff, but just let me cover just a couple things. We do have two board variances that you're going to hear tomorrow. One of those the division has recommended denying. One the division has recommended that you do it. Both of them were outside our purview to deal with. So, and you understand that process. So Judy will present those tomorrow at the board meeting. On the next agenda item, Bucks, Bulls, and Once a Lifetime, I just want to point out that our recommendation, one of the things that we do and is that if we hear something good at the racks or something that the rack passes something that we think was really a good idea, we amend our proposal to incorporate that. Now, you can still amend our proposal, incorporate anything you want, or not take that in. But there are two items that came up at the racks that we believe are good ideas that we hadn't thought about. And so when Anise presents the Bucks, Bulls, and Once a Lifetime, the proposal he presents will be exactly the same as he did at the racks, except that there'll be two items that we'll make changes to in our recommendation. Both of those items were passed by a rack. One of those dealt with the Uinta Basin extended archery hunt boundary. We had suggested one change. The RAC suggested some additional change, and we thought that was a good idea. The region liked it. Anise liked it, so we'll incorporate that in our recommendation tomorrow. And then the other one is on the Willard Peak goat hunt dates, that there was discussion and recommendation, and we think that what the RAC proposes is a good idea. And so we're going to modify our proposal to incorporate that as well. So those two changes. on CWMU management plans and permit numbers. The division is going to recommend one change in our situation on a CWMU, and this is addressing a problem that came up after the RAC meeting. So the RAC didn't hear this, so when this is presented, probably the appropriate thing to do, Dell, it's in the northern region, is ask the RAC chair if he believes his RAC. They haven't had a chance to hear it. It's a fairly simple change. It actually cuts back the number of moose permits on a CWMU. So you'll hear that when Boyd will address that. Landowner, there were a couple other discussions about CWMUs, but nothing that we're going to incorporate into our situation, our presentation. Landowner permits, no changes from what was presented to the RAC. So that's agenda item number 8. Number 9 is the conservation permit audit, and Greg will present that, and then Greg and I will be available to answer your questions if you have some about the audit. We changed the summary table a little bit to try to give you a better picture of how the dollars are from what we've done in the past. So, but we don't believe there'll be anything controversial in the audits this year. We're not recommending suspending anybody or anything like that from the conservation permit program. And then the last action item is the one-year conservation permits. For three of the board members, this is kind of new, although John's quite familiar with it, the process. But the majority of our groups, the majority of our permits are issued at three-year blocks that we do, and that actually new time period is coming up this coming year. We'll do the next three-year allocation. But for small organizations that are just getting involved or ones that just want to stay small, the rule allows them to get permits 1 year at a time. It limits greatly the number of permits they can get. Still has to fall within the overall cap that the rule lays out of 5% or 8, no more than 5% or 8 permits on any hunt unit. We had two applicants. One of them is new, and one of them had permits last year. And when we say new, it's actually not new. They had permits a couple years ago but didn't have any last year. So they have both applied. We've reviewed those, and in your packet is the recommendation on who gets what permits, and I'll present that tomorrow. And you can ask questions about that. And then maybe if everything works well, this is the last time you'll hear me present the conservation permit stuff, and Kevin will take it over in the coming year. So we have kind of a transition. He's going to, rather than split it right in the middle of the year, he's going to take things over the 1st of January. So Kevin will now become the conservation permit, whatever we want to call him. Any questions on...
One question. I believe on the one-year conservation permits, one of the awardees or proposed awardees this year was suspended from the program with prejudice, and there were stipulations of what had to be done to get back. And
yes, they have met those requirements, including a staff change.
They're allowed then to apply for multiple permits the first year?
Multiple, but they start over, Ernie. So the limit that they can have no more than $20,000 worth of permits in the first year, they, by being out 1 year, they go back to the beginning of that. So there's kind of two criteria to make sure that stays small. Because if somebody wanted to work the system, they could probably grow really big by working the system. So there's limits on how the one-year permits, how many any one group can get. And that all of our recommendations fall within the criteria in the rule, Ernie.
Let me ask you one thing, Alan. Regarding the permits, when you give them to these conservation groups, with every case but one, it's the national organization. The SCI is a local chapter. Can that be changed?
It could be changed. The way the rule reads, Dell, is it has to be one or the other. We wrote it that way because we wrote it that it has to be either the national or a state chapter, but not both. Because at one time we actually had two applications from one of those groups, one from the local and one from the national. So we revised the rule to read it has to be one or the other, and we kind of let the group decide which they want to do. So SCI, if SCI National wanted to apply, then they could contact us and say we want to apply, and that change could be made. So it's that's allowable in the rule now.
What if you have competing state chapters?
If you had competing state chapters, we would probably go to the national and say, which one of these is your state chapter, which is the one that you want representing you.
Okay. That's good. Any other questions?
Kevin will know all these answers next year.
All right.
Thing. What's that? On?
They want you to keep them, Alan.
No, well, the only person that's going to make me keep them is Jim.
He's going to say, I'll make that motion.
I don't think he can.
Okay. We're done, aren't we? Thank you, folks.